Listen to The Core on the Envision Radio Network. Copyright 2014.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know.
The revolution starts now.
This is Night Call. Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the riff at 4WRIF. That's 49743. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Night Call. Unfortunately, Jalene is off tonight under the weather. She was down doing a DJ gig at the Detroit Boat Show. It should be ice boats, right? But anyway, getting ready for the summer with the big annual Detroit Boat Show. And she just said she's just started feeling worse and worse and worse and worse. And she said, and when she says she can't do it, because she's a trooper, she is under the weather. But it just happened like that, and it was kind of like a flu thing. And at my house, my wife all of a sudden said, I feel like I'm getting a cold. This was about maybe 4 hours ago, and poof, it just came on like that. By the time I left, she's going, I can't believe I'll stop crying. It is winter, isn't it? The good news is there's a beautiful, beautiful full moon out tonight, and it's crisp and clear. Of course, it means it's going down to zero. This is the endless winter, right? That's been used a lot. And probably the phrase you hear the most is bitterly cold. And it is going to zero tonight. And then there's a warming trend. It's going to be nice, isn't it? When all this snow melts, where is it going to go? Well, Probably a lot of places we don't want it to go. Look at what's happening in England. I don't know if you've seen this. Huge floods. Probably more flooding than in 500 years. Droughts out in the west. These huge snowstorms. And we've gotten it. We've gotten it pretty mild compared to a lot of what's happening in the Northeast. And there's even snow in places like India, certainly here where it's not expected in the Southeast. And I think Jalene and I were talking last week how when you open up these right-wing news sites, it's like the Weather Channel, because they're saying, it's freezing here, it's never been colder, the Great Lakes are freezing. Because to them, that means what? Their word, there's no global warming. What's happening is that there's massive climate change, climate change, and the warming trend with all this ice melting up by the North Pole, it forcing, you know, you've seen this, haven't you? I mean, this is standard stuff. I mean, are we still talking about these climate change deniers? I mean, they're like Holocaust deniers or something. Same mentality. I mean, like, what do they have invested in it? You just can't figure it out, can you? I mean, and why is it this right-wing thing? Why are these conservatives and right-wingers so unwilling to admit all this? As I've always said, say that the vast majority of climatologists, scientists, everybody says that there's massive human-caused climate change going on. So you figure you want to stop dumping stuff into the atmosphere, the stuff that causes it, right? So it turns out we're wrong. So what happens? You just have a cleaner atmosphere. That's all there is to it. Nothing else. If they're wrong, and we don't do anything. That's why they're conservatives. They want to conserve things as they are, continuing to pollute our planet. They're okay with that. I don't know why. They're breathing the same crap we are. They suffer from the same diseases. They get asthma. They get cancer. I don't know. I never understood their mentality. Very weird. It's almost, I can almost sense it. I can't articulate it. Sometimes I hear these folks, and it's almost like they're nihilist. You know, want to destroy everything. I don't know. I mean, is that fair? Maybe not. Anything you want to talk about, though, including that, is fair game. I was going to say our. Well, it is ours. Jefferson is here, of course, and he's sitting in the other room with the phones, 248-544-WRIF, 248-544-9743. I don't have one piece of good news tonight. Maybe you could come up with something for us, but my computer crashed. Oh. And one of the things that I always do is I always do backups. In fact, my little adage is, if you don't have a backup of your backup, I don't even have any sympathy for you. So I have backups of my backups of my backups. So that's okay. But it's all got to be restored. It's just the biggest nuisance in the world. So, you know, Mr. Smarty Pants, right? I'm telling people, saying, I lost everything. I said, you have a backup? No. And I go, well, hey, what do you expect? But what I, you know, kind of knew in the back of my mind, and what caused the meltdown of it, was the fact that it was filthy inside, that it was just covered, absolutely covered with dust. And also because it's a desk model and it was on the floor and it was against the desk, so all of the ports were, you know, the cooling ports were just covered with dust. So I cut my own throat. All right. I mean, it's going to take a few days to put it together, but not much happening on our Facebook page. There's still good stuff there. You can take a look at facebook.com/nightcall. And if you'd like to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. My site, my personal site, Peter Werbe. That's werbe.com. Bad news for the UAW, United Auto Workers. Lost a big one. Lost a big one trying to organize the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And that was Bob King's goal. His term as United Auto Workers president, UAW president, was to unionize several of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. And they didn't have the kind of resistance that you see, say, like at Walmart or something like that, because these European auto companies all have big unions, and they're the best paid people in Europe, and the companies are profitable, and they have these worker management councils that the companies feel work for. The vote was 712 to 626 against joining the union, which meant if 50 votes would have flipped the other way, they would have made it. But I don't know what it says, other than who knows what goes through the minds of these people that figure somehow they're better off without a union. Now, it's interesting, too, because that the VW company said it was neutral, even to the point where it looked pretty much like they concurred with a union being there, because they wanted to form these German-style works councils, as they call them. It's a committee of white-collar and blue-collar workers who develop policies on work rules and on plant hours and other issues. And Volkswagen, which has unions and work councils at all of its 105 other plants, everywhere except in the good old USA. Well, number one on that, I guess. They think one reason the UAW lost was that VW workers, so they already felt they were paid well and treated well, and it led them to question why they needed a union and to pay union dues. Well, that's a consideration. VW, you can tell just by the fact that they're not a punitive company, was a pretty decent place to work, and they weren't being arbitrary and weren't doing speed-ups and all that. But the deal is the VW, and remember, VW was okay with this. The VW workers average about $19.50 an hour. Let's call it $20 an hour. So what is it? I always forget that formula. Is that 40 grand a year or something? Yeah. About the same as new workers in the Detroit automaker's lower tier, but about $9 an hour less than workers in Detroit's upper tier. And VW workers earn several dollars less than employees at most other transplants. So they actually could have made more money. But a lot of it was based on threats from local politicians and also these right-wing groups that came in from outside and put up like shots of the Packard plant and saying, brought to you by the United Auto Workers. I mean, Packard? How many of you that are alive remember when they were making Packards? When did Packard go out of business? All right. Hey, Jefferson, you were talking about looking stuff up like this. He wants me to type it out. I can't do both. So I think like the last Packard was like 1958. And so it's not like the United Auto Workers sunk Packard or anything like that. But where you see race creep in was these right wingers were putting up billboards that had United Auto Workers and they had, a line through it, and Obama. So it said United Obama Workers. And I wonder what the racial breakdown here was. That would be very, very interesting. There was all this anti-union pressure, and these Republicans said that the Republican-controlled legislature was unlikely to approve further subsidies to Volkswagen if the plant unionized. The mayor came out against this, Senator Bob Corker. They were doing everything they could to keep the union out. Why? What do they have vested in this? I mean, partly they say, other companies aren't going to come to that area if it's heavily unionized, right? And in fact, the South, you know, has this incredible anti-union tradition. And Chattanooga, for instance, used to have lots of textile mills and metal foundries, and many of them were unionized. But when they closed in recent decades, the textile mills went where? Overseas, right? And the foundries were shut down because of pollution problems. Many townspeople blamed the labor unions. That's what it says here in the article in the New York Times. The thank you, Jefferson. The Packard plant in Detroit complex closed in 1958. Hey, yeah, I hit it right in the head. So is this the fault of unions? In an odd way, yes. In an odd way, unions were responsible for driving all industrial concerns out of the United States, if you look at it really cockeyed. There is a causal relationship, because labor is a commodity. Our labor is bought on the market. And if it's left to the market, like, you know, conservatives want, the so-called free market. That means no controls on it. Then you're working for Bangladesh wages, where the textile mills go, or you're working for Mexican wages, where some of the auto plants, the auto suppliers went. So labor unions in that regard are responsible. They made the mistake that there was some loyalty. I mean, this is a joke, and they should have known better. That there's some loyalty not to the almighty dollar, not to the small 1% of the stockholders who own these auto companies or textile mills or steel mills or something like that, but rather they thought to the community and maybe to a state and maybe to a city, something like Detroit that was the Motor City. Of course, it's not true. So they figured out long time ago, say in the 1950s, when, I mean, this is when Detroit began to sink, by the way. It wasn't 1967 or anything like that. It was the deindustrialization began when some of these automakers decided, hey, why should we be paying these guys, I don't know what it was back then, say $5 an hour, when we can take our little auto supplier plants and go down to Georgia and Alabama and pay those good old boys $1.25. I mean, I'm sure it was all white then, and they were just glad to do it in the same way that Mexican workers are and Chinese workers and Bangladeshi workers are, just waiting in line, take that money, even though it doesn't even compute into anything that we hoped was going to be a generalized standard of living. So all these companies, in their quest for the absolute profit, were willing, and hence able, to erode the standard of living of millions of Americans, sink cities like Detroit. And that's where the real blame lies. You think I'm right? Or you think I'm wrong? Let me know. 248-544-WRIF. Let me actually hear something. I'm interested in this. Here is, let's see, I got to get all my little buttons going. Don't have Jalene here to help me. It's Yaya. Is it Yaya or Yaya?
Yaya. Hi. How are you?
I'm good.
Okay. Things are happening in Venezuela right now as we speak. There is 60,000 Cuban National Guards that are in the city right now shooting the innocent people because they want to express themselves, and obviously Maduro doesn't want that. He's taking that out of the Constitution. We're not going to have any more freedom of speech or freedom of expression. He's shutting down social media. Nobody can Twitter. Nobody can Facebook. If they'll catch you sending videos or photos on Facebook because of what's happening in Venezuela, you will get shut down.
Hey, what are you talking about? Cubans? There's no Cubans in Venezuela except for doctors and people like that.
No, they just sent, there is a video, if you want me to send it to you, I will send it to you, of the Cuban National Guard. They went over there right now, and they're supporting the Venezuelan National Guard on shooting and killing the students that are protesting right now.
Well, also, in fairness, the opposition has been pretty violent as well, and has done a lot of shooting of its own and shooting government supporters. I mean, they regularly have these opposition snipers that shoot into pro-government crowds. So it's a pretty nasty situation. But you said 60,000 Cuban National Guard.
6,000. No, I'm sorry, 6,000. I'm sorry.
You know, I got to tell you, yeah, it's a terrible situation. I was in Venezuela in 2008, 2006? Can't remember. 2006. And there was enormous opposition at that time to President Chavez. And that there should be. I mean, a good, robust opposition is pretty good, something we don't particularly have here. But believe me, if thousands of Cuban troops landed in Venezuela, this would be an international crisis. So whatever is happening there, it's internal to what's happening there. I got to tell you, I don't like either side.
Yeah, me neither.
Okay.
Me neither.
Yeah.
You know, some people are dying, like, right in front of my house over there. Like, you know, my neighbors are sending me videos of what's going on. right now across my street in Venezuela. They're shooting innocent people. They're throwing tear gas. They're, you know, they're just doing all these crazy things just because the students that were protesting for peaceful, they were doing a peaceful demonstration for the youth day that was on the 12th. And that's what's happening right now. And ever since then, they killed, you know, a couple of students, and then they kidnapped other more. Of course, the whole country is going to go off of them, you know?
I never could understand, though, with all the wealth, why they couldn't control things like crime, which is soaring, and inflation, which is soaring. So, you know, there's a lot to be... you know, to be concerned about. Look what's happening, same thing. Look what's happening in Ukraine and what's, you know, ongoing in places like Bahrain, where, you know, people take their lives in their hands when they go out to protest. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate that update, Yaya. And that's always a concern of mine, because what's happening in this country is the militarization of the police. I mean, they don't do what they do in so many other countries. But why, when there's a peaceful demonstration in Washington, that they send out police that look like they're ready to fight in Afghanistan? Absolutely uncalled for. So I suppose that will make some of you happy that the United Auto Workers were defeated in Chattanooga in its efforts. I don't understand why. I don't understand. I mean, and I'm not sure what of this vote of 712 to 626 against joining the union. What these guys think would be the negative? Well, they say they may not want to pay dues or something like that. Well, you know, if you're going to get a raise, I mean, see, one of the things that VW, which I said, did not oppose the unionization. So they said they vowed to remain neutral and not oppose unionization, which is very, very unusual, where you get stuff like Walmart, who's been accused of illegally firing workers across the country. Right? They do that regularly. They're the most vicious anti-union corporation in the United States of any particular size. I mean, maybe some small shops will beat them, but in terms of big ones. But VW is absolutely okay with having unions. It's all these right-wingers that are against it. And why, like I say, 626 out of about 1,300 people think that... they wouldn't get a raise. They wouldn't have a grievance procedure. They wouldn't have job specifications. They wouldn't, and they would be able to take part. They would be able to take part in these works councils that got together, management and blue collar workers, and together they developed policies on work rules, plant hours, and other issues. So why does VW want to do it? Is it some left wing? Company that wants workers' councils? You know, they've got stockholders. They have to show their profits to the 1% that own them and all that. They want to do this. They want unions because they think it's good for business. They think that it regularizes the process of production, that it doesn't allow for festering worker complaints, that there is ongoing face-to-face meetings daily. So get that. So here you get a situation where the management wants a union, which is very unusual, and all these right-wingers say no. The only thing I ever said good about, I think I reported this last week, the Tennessee governor wants 2 free years of community college and technical schools. This is Governor Bill Haslam. He also went apoplectic, though, about the idea that a union would be able to organize VW workers. So that's good that he's urging 2 free years of community college and technical school. But one of the things that I've said always, why isn't college completely free anyway? Why is there this arbitrary cutoff? You get to go through high school completely free, right? Then all of a sudden you got to rack up $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt. I don't get that. Shouldn't all school be free? I mean, if it's about people talk about it, everything from being the key to advancement to the key to keeping our nation competitive, the key to people getting good salaries. So why should we jack young people up and their families with these enormous debts. Do you get that? I don't. I mean, does anybody have a reason why universities shouldn't be free? I mean, it gets back to, we can't afford it. Why are we the richest country in the world, and the only thing we can afford is trillions of dollars for war, preparation for war, right? Giving money to other countries and what have you. I mean, do you read all this stuff or see this stuff on television about these water mains bursting in Detroit? That's happening all over the country. And one of the reasons, for instance, that there's so many power lines down around the country in the southeast, I mean, I know there's ice and all that, but even in the best of times, the electrical grid is insufficient for the demand. And on the other hand, we're spending billions of dollars for road construction in Afghanistan. And someone said, wait a minute, did that guy on the radio just say we are building roads to the tune of billions of dollars for roads in Afghanistan? Yeah. And how many potholes have you hit this winter? All right, give me a call. Peter Werbe here without Jalene Jordan. It's 248-544-WRIF and 248-544-9743 numerically. And if you'd like to make a Facebook, you can do that always, facebook.com/nightcall, but also an email comment, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I thought, was there one up there? It was curious to me. I asked a couple of people if they knew who Pete Seeger was, and they said, I don't know, isn't that some guy didn't just die, some folk singer or something like that? Yeah, very, very not only prominent, but influenced so many of modern singer-songwriters. And like on his 90th birthday, Pete Seeger died at 94 just a couple of weeks ago, and he influenced Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen and John Mellencamp, people like that. Probably lost on the modern generation of rockers, to be sure. But I interviewed Pete Seeger in 2007. You can go to my website or Facebook page, and it's there, the interview. You can link up to it. But there's apparently also, if you go to the PBS website, you can find this film that he was in called Pete Seeger, The Power of Song. And thanks to Joe for sending that in. Let's see. Mitt Romney, he says, Bill Clinton embarrassed the nation with Monica Lewinsky. These guys, they don't let go, do they? You know? It's like guys know that with the women in their life. Like, they never forget anything, right? You know, no matter how long it's been since they, I remember when you, and you go, wow, man, wasn't that like 6 years ago or something like that? But this is what these Republicans are like. He embarrassed the nation. He breached his responsibility. Where I don't know who they think they're talking to, because this is so lost on anybody except for people like him. Was he a dog? Yeah, Bill, the big dog, right? Did he lie? Yeah. Wow. Amazing. A politician. And he lied. What is up with that? So why are they doing this? Well, they're doing it, of course, because of Hillary, because of the election. But you know what? That could even conceivably backfire. Well, first off, it'll backfire because nobody will care, and except for the people that already, you know, despise the Clintons and all that. But, you know, women are a big factor in the vote, and if anything, it'll probably bring sympathy for Hillary. I don't know, although I'm sure she doesn't want any sympathy vote. All right, let's take a couple of calls. We'll do a break, and then we'll I'd like to talk about this trial that just happened. The guy, what do you do when you hear loud rap music? Well, he just shoot the people down. What else? You know, another law-abiding citizen gone rogue. But let's see, here's Colin in Howell. Hey, Colin, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what you were talking about with college not being free. I mean, I'm in college right now, but I'm 25, so it's like I've been through college. I failed out a couple of times. I've been back to college, and it's like it really made me see that there's a difference between college and high school. In high school, you can literally just skate through it, and that's what I did. I just didn't care. I just didn't study. I didn't do anything to be in high school, and I graduated. And it's like in college, you can't do that, because if you do that, then you're just going to be put in the workforce, and you're not going to care in the workforce, and you're going to be getting paid a bunch of money and not care. It's like, so somewhere along the line, you have to motivate people to actually care. And so if you force them to pay for college, you motivate them to go. Or even if you offer them all these loans, you're still, you might be getting a couple of stragglers, but those people are going to drop out. So it's like the people who really actually want to be in the workforce and want to make the real money, they pay and they make it. And, you know, it doesn't always work, but for the most part, it does. And in the long run, it does. And it's like it's proven itself over hundreds of years.
Well, there used to be free colleges. I mean, there was a number of colleges, famous colleges. Jefferson, here's another thing you can look up. What they called land-grant colleges. I'm not even sure where the phrase came from, like Michigan State University. I believe those used to have free tuition, things like the City College in New York that produced all these famous people that was free. And I don't know if there are still any at all. But, you know, actually, Colin, I have some thoughts on what you said, but I would rather, this isn't directly affecting me right now, so how about this? We'll just shoot it out to people and see how they respond to it, okay?
Okay.
All right, totally thanks for your opinion. Okay, so Colin says cash for college makes some sense because you're only going to go there. If you're going to take on this debt, whether it's small or very large, and that'll be a motivator. If we just let free college just be filled with slackers. Okay. We're also talking about unions. The UAW just lost a big one in Chattanooga. And here's David. David's in Detroit. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
My thought on this, well, at least they had the chance to vote for it or against it, and they were free to do that, and that's a good thing. We should keep that in mind for whatever reason. But there's one statistic that you conveniently left out, and it's the fact that the UAW in particular, and I know this because I am a UAW member, contributed $58 million last year alone to Democrat candidates. And maybe some of these people just don't believe in the loony left philosophy and just didn't want to contribute to that. Maybe they want to vote in a conservative union because down there in Tennessee it is a right-to-work state. And maybe they just don't buy into the UAW. Maybe they would like to have a different union.
The Democratic.
I don't know.
The Democratic Party, you mean? You misspoke yourself. You said Democrat Party. The Democratic Party is its name. You misspoke yourself.
Oh.
That's the only thing. I was just correcting you. And you know what I'm talking about, right? And only probably maybe a few people would know. Well, that's very possible. There's not, you know, what happened in Europe going back into the 1880s, for instance, the Pope, had this encyclical supporting the right of unions to organize way back then. And there was a number of Catholic unions, Christian unions, and they organized. They didn't want to be associated with the other unions, particularly as they got into the 20th century, that were almost exclusively socialist, communist, and anarchist unions. So, yeah, why not? But there's nothing like that here. And I'll tell you, I mean, by the way, David, I'm sure you would appreciate, what do they call it, full disclosure? Jalene and I both worked for the UAW as broadcasters. So, you know, we have a lot, and we know Bob King and your president and all that till next June or this June or July, whatever it is. But, I guess I don't understand the motivation. Oh, I know what I'm sorry. I was treading water there. Remember, you said they spent $58 million. You know, I don't know if my union does, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, which belongs to AFL union. I think because it's the broadcasters union that we don't spend, I should know this, we don't spend any money on political candidates. Because it would give the appearance of, favoritism. Although there's me and there's Bill O'Reilly, who's in my union, and Brian Williams, everybody. But the UAW does not want to spend one penny on elections. And if they said, look, corporations cannot contribute any money to political campaigns, and billionaires cannot contribute any money to campaigns, and unions can't contribute any money to campaigns, they would feel wonderful. Because for one thing, the unions can't afford it. And the other thing is, the other side can't. They got all the billionaires on their side.
Well, you know, from my perspective, I see these guys that are supposed to be in there representing the worker, and instead they have a really a huge interest in these elections. And, you know, to say that, well, they do so because Democrats are for the unions, I can tell you that Democrats, Democratic folks, whatever you want to call
them. No, the Democrats. That's right. It's the Democratic Party, and it's the people that belong to it are the Democrats. Right.
Yeah, and they may talk that game. When it comes down to legislation, they're really not all that different from Republicans in that regard. And the evidence is in some of these votes that, you know, you would say are for the worker, and then, you know, Democrats and Republicans alike vote against some of these.
Hello, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've always often thought that the unions were wasting their money financing the Democratic Party. And what it's gotten down to, you really hit it, David. What it's really gotten down to is they're spending tens of millions of union dues in order to keep the Republicans out. I mean, that's about it. In other words, that what I've always said in here, that the Democrats are better than a stick in the eye, which isn't much of an endorsement, and the Republicans are a stick in the eye. All right, listen, we'll talk more another time. I'm way past when I got to do this. Always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us. Jalene's not here, so, hey, you join us.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend, brought to you by Meijer. Shop Meijer and save on everything to warm you up this winter. Find easy, healthy meals for your family, warm weather gear for outside, and more at Meijer. The Rick.
Progressive presents Flo's newest jam. Bundling will make you feel like the mayor of Savingsville.
Bundle your home and auto together, and you'll feel like the mayor of Savingsville. Yes, you will. A town famous for the world's biggest puppy.
Bundle your home and auto together and save. Visit Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Home insurance underwritten by Homesite Group, Boston Mass, and other unaffiliated companies. Available in most states.
Had enough of winter? Look ahead to summer and the warmth of the sun at the Action Water Sports Event In-House Boat Show, February 20th through the 23rd. Forget the big boat show hassle and go to Action Water Sports, where parking, admission, and food are free. See the completely redesigned Mastercraft Pro Star ski boat featuring the absolute smallest wake in the industry, a convertible bow area, walk-through transom, and standard zero-off GPS speed-based control. Learn about the new Gen 2 surf system offered in the X-Series boats that gives you instant, endless, epic surf wakes. Discover the difference between memorable and unforgettable with the Cobalt boats, including the new 220S with a convertible observer seat. Cobalt caters to the boater's every need with options like the flip-down swim step and easy access through the transom. Take this opportunity to stock up for summer with savings at Michigan's best water sports pro shop, loaded with all the top brand water ski and wakeboard gear. Get to Action Water Sports In-House Boat Show, February 20th through the 23rd on Old US 23, just south of Exit 75. Get more details at actionwater.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Julian off tonight under the weather. Victim of the endless winter, huh? 248-544-WRIF. 248-544-9743. I was talking about Tennessee, where the UAW just lost a key union recognition vote at the VW plant. I'm saying I just couldn't understand why in the world these guys would vote against it. David from Detroit called in and said he's a UAW worker, but sounds like he's, I don't know, conservative or libertarian, and thought maybe some of the workers didn't like the idea that unions spend tens of millions of dollars trying to get members of the Democratic Party elected, politicians from the Democratic Party. If people caught that, and maybe I'm not sure whether David did or not, he said the Democrat Party. This is some, and I'm not talking about you here, David, if you're listening still. There's something about all these right-wing talk show hosts that they call it the Democrat Party. I'm not sure exactly what they're on about. They don't call it the Democratic Party. They call it the Democrat Party. And so I was just being kind of, well, a little rude to David, saying, hey, it's the Democratic Party. That's the name of the party. It's not the Democrat Party. People that belong to the party, which I don't, and if someone said to me, are you a Democrat or a Republican? I would say neither, right? Okay. And so I was saying I couldn't understand why people in a situation with a friendly company would not want to have a union there. This was VW, They are, in fact, they really wanted the union there because they want to have these worker management councils. They want to have these work councils where they deal effectively with problems everywhere from the shop floor to the way management schedules work and a lot of stuff, a lot of work rules and what have you. Also, let's see, it was Colin and Howell who, when I said I thought all universities should be free, and I just didn't get it why there was this arbitrary cutoff point that wound up saddling young people as soon as they get out, rather than, hey, we're on the road. They've got this $40,000 weight around their neck. And Colin said he thought it was a good idea that colleges are not free because this was a motivator. That only the people that really wanted to do it would wind up with going to college. If not, and he didn't say this, these are my words, but the implication was that you would have slackers, right? I mean, I was a slacker in college. I never graduated. I was such a slacker. Let's see, we were also talking about free colleges and hear from Jefferson, who is also taking your calls at 248-544-WRIF. He says, he writes, Michigan State is the only land-grant university in Michigan. It's not free anymore, though, as most people that go there know. Around 1870, land-grant colleges were established, and their tuition was free to help them get off the ground. I see. Okay. Let's see. Here is Fred. Fred's in Detroit. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Peter.
Hi.
Well, I have a few things, if you can just hang on for a second.
Go for it.
Well, first of all, considering what Mitt Romney had to say.
He said that Bill Clinton was an embarrassment because of Monica Lewinsky. Everybody says, yeah, oh, yeah, I remember. Now, who? Yeah, oh, yeah, I remember her.
Well, first of all, mission accomplished was a bigger embarrassment. And so was Iran-Contra.
Yeah, right, going back to Reagan. Yeah, sure.
And so was the Iran weapons swap or whatever that was. I forget. Iran-Contra.
Yeah, that was. And how about Iraq and Afghanistan? Hey, and you know what? You know how many people got killed because of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky? Let me see. Zero. And how many people got killed because of all those other embarrassments? Yeah, yeah.
Now, you had a guy who called in, and I guess he thought that money was an incentive.
For college, yeah.
Out of college.
Yeah.
Public education through the high school level is a mandatory thing. Slackers who don't want to be in school in the first place aren't going to sit in college. Not the kind of slackers he's talking about. So you're right. College could be free, because if you don't want any further schooling, you just won't show up in the college classroom.
That's right. That makes sense. I hadn't thought of it. Like, I mean, I was a total slacker. I finished. You know how old I was when I finished college? 20. Or, I'm sorry, high school. I finished high school when I was 20. I never finished college. Couldn't do it.
And as far as the UAW vote goes,
yeah.
Well, people, and I heard the guy also use the term loony left.
Yeah, oh, I forgot about that one. He calls the Democrats loony left?
Oh. Yeah, it slipped in there, and the first thing I thought about was the uptight right.
Well,
and how it's basically all money, and like you've been saying, money is what really separates the two parties. And so how you can ever vote for a party that's all about money, I'll never know.
Yeah. I don't get it either. I understand people with a lot of money doing it, but I don't understand how the average middle class or working person does. All right. Thank you very much, Fred. Appreciate your call.
Mm-hmm.
As always, thank you for joining us. Here's Kevin. He's in Wasteland. As I hope that's what you're calling it, Kevin. Are you?
Yeah, that's what I.
Yeah, well, I've heard it. That goes way back. What's up?
Yeah.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what poverty like really means, because I don't really understand what poverty means anymore. Like, according to CBS.com, and they were citing the Census Bureau, 83% of poor families in America, I believe this was in 2013, had air conditioning. another, the 83% had DVD players. I think it was 81% have cell phones, of poor Americans have cell phones. According to Heritage.com, and they cited the Department of the U.S. Department of Energy Residential Energy Dependence Survey, shows that the typical poor family have a car, they have two TVs, cable or satellite TV, and when the family has children, they typically have an Xbox or PlayStation.
Well, you're quoting this, and I'm not even saying, I'm not challenging the statistics. A right-wing site, which is conservative in the sense that they, as I always say, want to conserve things as they are, and they want to conserve the distribution of wealth the way it is. And so essentially what they're saying is in a country that's the wealthiest country in the world, which isn't reflected in the way that people live. I mean, where people live all, you know, well are places like Denmark. Now, yeah, I mean, these have become things like telephones and cable and cell phones and cars. I mean, you've got to be, to not have those things, you've got to be like in the bottom 5% or something like that. But it, by any realistic statistics in terms of income, that that this country approaches being half poor or near poor. And what do people spend their money on? Well, they spend it on their cars and fixing them because the cars are about 8 or 9 years old. They try to, you know, get the cheapest cell phone rate. They want cable in their house. They, you know, so yeah, they have those amenities, but the, you know, if you're trying to make the argument that the life of the poor is good in this country, I just don't know what to tell you. Do they live better than the poor in Mexico or Uganda?
I'm not arguing that it's good. I'm just suggesting that maybe it's gotten better. Because, I mean, you go back, I mean, when I was growing up, I'm 25, when I was growing up in the mid-90s, my family didn't have air conditioning. We didn't have cable TV.
Well, that was, you know, that was now, a long time ago, actually, you know, in real terms. I don't, I wonder about that air conditioning, but...
I mean, air conditioning is, I mean, that's an amenity. I mean, you don't need it. I mean, it's for comfort.
Well, yes and no. I mean, because our standards, like in Mumbai, in India, now, which now, like half of the electricity used in this hot Indian city goes to air conditioning. And it's compared to what? I mean, when there was no air conditioning and people lived there, they just kind of accepted it as, that's the way it was. If you tell somebody now, today, you live in a house without air conditioning, it's like, telling them you got, you know, you don't have indoor plumbing, right? You know, what becomes, you know, what you're saying, an amenity or a luxury has now become a necessity. And tell somebody you don't have a cell phone or tell somebody, I mean, you're poor and you don't have a car. I mean, you go in Detroit. I mean, if you're in New York, I think most New Yorkers don't have cars. But, you know, everywhere else, you have to have a car to get to work. I mean, what's the conclusion of all this? The poor don't have it so bad?
Partially. I'm just suggesting that maybe the poor have actually gotten better off in the last 20, 40 years. I mean, maybe
there has been, I mean, it's an odd statistic. I mean, one of the biggest hits against poverty was Medicare, which took millions and millions of seniors out of poverty. And so Social Security combined with Medicare just helped so many people. Food stamps has allowed so many people to not have to be on not have to suffer what they would if there wasn't food stamps, although, you know, those are being cut back. But the idea that, that it's difficult for so many people to survive without government aid, without, and these folks run out of food stamps. I mean, there really is oftentimes millions of kids in this country that are in, what do they call it, in danger of, not of malnutrition, at risk for hunger. That's what they call it. I mean, poverty, there shouldn't be any poverty in a country this wealthy, you know, but there is. And it's because,
well, I mean, what is poverty? I mean, poverty is just a set wage that is lower than.
Yeah,
average.
You're right. Well, I don't know. You know, I've never, well, in a way, I don't know. Maybe I did live poor when I was in my early 20s. Look, I mean, to some extent, what do you need to live? You need, you know, housing and warmth, and you need food and, you know, some culture, something to entertain yourself, right? Or and a lot of people before the modern era, I mean, or in other countries today, they live pretty bare lives, but, you know, they're doing okay. But I don't know. I mean, I want to think about this more, Kevin, because this is an interesting conception. But the only thing I would say, careful in it, because the conservatives use this a lot to justify things as they are. Although, you know, I agree. I mean, if people did without some of those things. I don't know. What, are we really going to tell people to go without air conditioning? All right. Thank you very much. More stuff to talk about. Thank you. Here is Tom. Tom is in Wyandotte. Tom, what do you think about this college thing being free?
Well, I think it would be good. My kid's got a $38,000 bill now.
Oh.
And he can't get a job. Now, my friend came from Poland. He's been here 25, 27 years. When he had, there was free college there in Poland.
Yeah, sure.
Everybody had got to go. I don't think there was no missing around. You went there to learn or you were put out. Everybody had to go to college or everybody had to do 2 years in the service, males at least. He had to defect, or he did defect, because he was speaking stuff he shouldn't have. He came here to the United States from Gdansk, Poland, which he got 50 cents in his pocket when he reached New York, migrated somehow to Hamtramck, and now he's probably worth at least $1 million.
He made the right move. Nothing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, they held his wife and his child for 5 years.
Yeah. Oh.
But they're doing good now, and I think if you go to school, you don't go there to mess around. At least college, that's not a place to do that, I don't think.
Well, you know what? Actually, between what you said and also, let me see who I'm forgetting who it was also saying that the slackers are just going to kind of slack off. Like, I got to tell you, I was kind of a slacker. I mean, I was really a slacker in high school and in college. And, you know, I essentially got blown out, you know. I mean, so there wasn't, you know, rigidly, but, and I was lucky enough to have my dad paying for it because I was, you know, from a middle-class family. And he just said, why do I get the feeling you're not doing anything but drinking and playing pool? And I'm thinking, how could he tell from so far away? All right, listen, I got to take a break, but thank you very much. And, yeah, 38 grand. And how old's your son?
He's 26 now.
26 and owing 38,000. That shouldn't
and
be.
And he's not in the field.
I know. I mean, that's the story of lots of folks.
Yeah.
All right, Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. Well, let's do some more on that when we come back. And I do want to get to this thing about this trial of where this guy figured, you know, hey, they're playing rap music. I got a gun. Let's shoot him. All right. Be right back.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Rev. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
This next song goes out to someone real special. Web developers. You've developed a worldwide web of convenience, and Geico.com is eternally grateful. Now everyone can pay bills, manage policies, maybe save big money on car insurance, all from the comfort of their desk chairs, recliners, and water beds. You're magicians with wands made of binary code, and that's why we're sending this next song out to you. For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com.
What is graphic design?
Graphic design informs.
It is the thread seen throughout advertising.
Graphic design persuades.
It is everywhere from logos to websites.
Graphic design organizes.
It is the organization of content and art.
Graphic design stimulates.
It markets to an audience.
Graphic design attracts attention.
Spex Howard School of Media Arts teaches the foundation skills to begin attracting attention of your own. Through layouts, visual arts, typography, web, and print design, Spex Howard prepares you for today's industry. There are just a few seats left in the graphic design class starting in January, so start the new year right by enrolling today. Call 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000 to make an appointment or visit spexhoward.edu.
During these tough economic times when many families are living paycheck to paycheck, it can be easy to lose sight of the importance of saving for the future. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling wants you to know there are some simple steps you can take to set aside dollars each month for retirement, college tuition, or unexpected expenses that could come your way. Most important is to review all your expenses and establish a monthly budget. Then examine every spending category and cut 10% from each. You can't reduce fixed expenses like rent or mortgage or a car payment, but you can easily cut back in many other areas like entertainment or using mass transit when possible instead of driving. And take a look at trying to bundle services such as your cell phone, land phone, cable TV, and internet service. For more tips and to speak with a certified credit counselor who can start you on the right track, call the NFCC at 800-388-2227 or visit debtadvice.org. This has been a public service message from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
101 WRIF.
Resolution. Hit WRIF.com and see Meltdown in action at Planet Fitness. See how easy it is in the no judgment zone with a Planet Fitness trainer. You could even win a Planet Fitness membership at WRIF.com.
Ta-da!
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Push play on that.
The Riff.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. Jalene is off tonight under the weather. You can ring us up at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. You can take a little response to Colin in Howell, who said that he thought that colleges, contrary to what I said, that colleges and universities should be free, he thought it ought to be that the fees were good, that it kept the slackers out. Let's see, Elliot writes in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com, the Walden family is the biggest pack of slackers that never went to college. And, of course, they're the heirs to the Walton, to the Walmart fortune, which totals up to about $120 billion, right? And it kind of leads into the one of the reasons they have $120 billion is because they're so virulently anti-union, and they do everything they can to keep unions out of their stores and pay their, what do they call them? Do they call them associates? The smallest wage they can. And, of course, you and I subsidize them because in their store they advise people how to apply for Medicaid and food stamps and what have you. So, essentially, you and I are paying. You and I, the taxpayer, are subsidizing and paying the health care for Walton workers. Now, you'd say, well, you know, look at that. They want to keep their money. If they paid decent wages to everybody and had the kind of health care that they could afford, you know, they wouldn't be worth $120 billion anymore together, the five of them. They'd probably be worth, I don't know, $119 billion. So there's some psychopathology that the wealthy share frequently. There's a number of generous, very rich people. In the main, there are these right-wing conservatives that hate the idea that anybody has the ability to have any control over. I mean, they're usually control freaks to begin with. But wouldn't you think that maybe the Waltons would say, hey, you know, there's five of us, and we had $4 billion. I mean, that's ridiculous, having a wealth of $4 billion. So that'd be $20 billion. So that's like $100 billion we could do good stuff with. Instead, it's just parked away somewhere. It's not even real money. It's not like, you know, like, what was in the comic books? Uncle Scrooge McDuck, right? Kept all his money in these vaults and all that. So it's nothing's happening with it. I mean, they would, for one thing, if they gave their employees raises, forget about the unions, if they gave their employees raises, you know what their employees would do? They would turn around and buy stuff at their stores. Now they probably just barely have enough. The other thing, and I don't have everybody's name in front of me, from Wyandotte, was that Kevin? Who said, gee, can you really consider people in the United States poor when even the poorest people have cell phones and cars and cable TV and stuff like that? I mean, we talk about poverty being endemic in this country. And poverty rates, the official poverty rates, have gone down the last 60 years. A lot of it having to do, though, as I said, with these programs that the conservatives have always opposed, like Medicare and Medicaid, what have you. Anyway, your comments, 248-544-WRIF, and also in numbers, 248-544-9743. You can join us on Facebook. One of the problems is that my computer went like that, so nothing's posted anywhere. And let me see how the brain is working. 1 a.m., I'll have a couple of interesting interviews. I always say that. And who is it? Oh, yeah. Guy that's going to jail, ex-mayor of a small little New York town, Vietnam veteran, and he used to be president of Veterans for Peace, veteransforpeace.org. And he and some other people were convicted of disorderly conduct in front of an air base where drones were launched, which, you'll hear what he has to say. And also, Peter Linebaugh, a book called Stop Thief. Let me see. Oh, no, I don't have my email open. Anyway, they're both really interesting. Let's see here. Winston Smith writes, free college would be a wonderful thing, but the primary requirement should minimum aptitude and obvious slackers should be identified and dropped out at regular intervals in their programs. Well, yeah. I mean, that happens, but you don't need that in there. That happens whether you're have free college or not. I mean, if you have bad grades, even though you're, getting this big debt going, you're out of there. You're absolutely out of there. Let's see. Here is Jill. Jill's in, almost said Jill's in poverty. Jill's in Rochester. Thanks for calling 248-544-WRIF. Hi, Jill. You're on the air.
Hi. I just like to make a statement about poverty.
Sure.
Poverty is not a shallow issue of somebody has cable and somebody has a tablet and somebody has a cell phone. It's an issue about quantifiable means of supporting yourself into the future. How many of these people have savings or 401k?
None.
They don't.
Next to none. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the whole point about poverty I wanted to make.
Jill, and as well, though, there is actually day-to-day issues about getting enough food for everybody, about... I mean, when in a consumerist society whose standards remain rigid, even though so many people's income has dropped, I mean, your kid wants $120 sneakers, or the kids want laptops and what have you. So in a way, it's relative, but there are some and there is a lot of insecurity about, people lose jobs and don't have the money to pay rent. I mean, think about how many foreclosures there has been. I mean,
You also have this push too. The right wing conservatives, they're always it's not just wages; it's everything across the board. They don't want you to have any unemployment. You don't get unemployment in every situation when you lose your job, but you don't have any savings. Whether or not you have cable and three or four cell phones, that's not the issue. I mean, you're not going to have them for long if you don't have any savings. Your unemployment runs out, and you're right back to square one. Now, let's say you get another job and you start your savings again. Well, then you're back in the cycle. Let's say we have another economic downturn. You can never get on clear footing. The wolf is always at the door.
Yeah,
and that's the point to be made about poverty in this country.
Well, I thought it was interesting that I'm forgetting again. I think it was Kevin who was quoting this very conservative so-called think tank, the Heritage Foundation think tank. And they're in the direct employ of the 1% of the billionaires who want to conserve society exactly as it's structured. They protect the fortunes at the top, whereas those at the bottom are considered to be there as a result of their own activity or lack of proper activity. And also, it's sort of assumed, well, why are these poor people having air conditioning and cell phones and cars and tablets and things like that?
Well, yeah, and it's also relative. I know there's certain schools where the standard of education in a high school, even a middle school, your children need that to go to the class. I know somebody right now who goes to class and, his school has, dictates that he has to have a tablet.
Sure.
So, it's not something out of the ordinary. And then with these think tank little organizations and whatnot, you kind of sort of have to take a look at, who's supporting them. A lot of these places, they're not, like you said, they're not independent. You have to look at who's propping them up. You can never take anything for face value when it comes to organizations like that. And you do have this push, it's sort of like some type of a myopic view of things that comes from the conservative right-wing groups, and it's just not even realistic.
Well, it actually,
and I wonder. And here is my real fear of things. The short-sightedness of these mentalities just boggles my mind, because when somebody doesn't make any money, it's like you said about Walmart. They can't turn around and spend it.
You would think, you would think they'd have a vested interest in at least, I mean, having a society where you don't have the kind of social disruption and poverty causes crime, and, I mean, they're always, the sociologists are always saying, what are the causes of crime? Well, crime predominantly emanates, not the big crime comes from the top, of course, but the kind of crime that most of us fear, robberies, break-ins, that kind of stuff, always in every society on earth where there's disparities of wealth comes out of the poorer communities. And you would think that if nothing else, for it to generate retail sales and to have a calmer, more peaceful society, that these rich people that have this obscene wealth that can't even do, I mean, what can you do if you have a family's worth $120 billion? I mean, what's her name? Alice Walton. She opens up a big, art museum down where their headquarters are in Arkansas and buys hundreds of millions of dollars of art, which is nice, but, doesn't do much. I mean, it would go a lot farther if it was in the pockets of the people that work for their company every day, eh?
You'll never see it. I mean, history's going to repeat itself. As far as I'm concerned, you know, I see this as the fall of Rome. Everything
okay.
it pretty much this country. There's nothing you can do when you look at it and just examine the facts. You know, you need thousands of dollars to get an education. You need an education to get thousands of dollars. If you do get an education, you can't come out and join the middle class because you now have thousands of dollars worth of debt over your head. And then, you know, like we had an earlier caller, you know, you come out of college, it doesn't mean you're going to get a job.
Right.
So the middle class is getting wiped out. What's going to happen is enough of this is going to happen until, you know, I don't know, the 20, 40 years from now, you know, there will be millions of people at the White House. And, you know, and until then, we'll just be hearing the whole let them eat cake. Nonsense coming from the conservatives,
well,
until they do themselves in.
Well, you know, Jill, you know what would have changed things? I mean, this, I can't say this for certain, but if this vote in Chattanooga, where if the UAW would have gained recognition at the VW plant, the way the VW management wanted and the right-wingers opposed it, this could have meant that the other plants in the South, Mercedes-Benz and Kia or whatever, this could have created a situation like the 1930s, where suddenly unionization created a social movement that demanded that people share in the wealth that this country was created, that it wasn't just this, you know, little teeny ruling class and then all the peons and the peasants and the proletariat below it. Or, although if they're going to be that, at least they should be, have a reward for the work that they do every day that creates the billions for these people at the top. But, I don't know. I mean, I think myopic short-sightedness, that's actually typifies them. Jill, thank you very much. I want to get some more calls. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye now. Here is, I'm doing something wrong here. Okay. Here is Carol in Detroit. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say everybody does not have air conditioning.
Okay.
Period. And when you get 85%, I'm very suspicious of the statistics.
I was wondering, you know.
You know.
Yeah. Boy, I'm getting this echo like I get with this other caller as well. Can you hear that? No.
No, I can't.
Probably not on your end. Well, let me do this. Actually, I can't. This is sounds awful. I don't know. Let me see. Okay. I just turned you down, so I can. I'll do it like that. Yeah, what do they always say? Figures don't lie, but liars can figure. But, I mean, I got to take, maybe I should look into those statistics a little.
I would question some of them.
Okay, well, thank you.
All righty.
All right, Carol. We'll do that. All right, Jefferson,
What percentage of poor people have air conditioning? All right. Here's, and if you're on hold now, please stick, and I'll get to you in a second. 248-544-WRIF, 248-544-9743. I don't know how many people were following this. This was national news, but there was this, what they call, racially tinged, tinged trial of Michael Dunn, this Florida guy who shot another teenager to death in a parking lot during a dispute over loud music. They said they couldn't agree on whether this Michael Dunn acted to protect himself or was guilty of murder. So it was a what they call a hung jury, and they declared a mistrial. However, they found this Dunn guilty of three counts of second-degree attempted murder because he got out of his car and started firing several times at this Dodge Durango Sport utility vehicle in which Jordan Davis, a 17-year-old, was killed. He was actually 18 yesterday. He would have been. Three other teenagers, the subjects of the attempted murder charges, were in the car but were not struck. And Dunn continued to fire the vehicle even as it pulled away. On the attempted murder convictions, he could be sentenced to 60 years in prison. But how in the world, that this guy gets out of his car? Well, he got claims that he saw a shotgun. And then, you know, reached into his gloved, box, pulled out a pistol, and just emptied, 10 shots into this car, or a number of them directly, killing, this young man. Now, I wish I would have had more of the testimony there, because he was talking about, he heard this rap crap and this thug music. Now, and these were all black kids that he shot at. Now, any number of things occur to me. Now, if I'm in a parking, who the hell is this guy who's in a parking lot and tells teenagers to turn the music down? I wonder if they would have been listening to country music or even rock that he would have had the same reaction. But it was thug music. It was that rap crap. I'm not a big fan of rap at all, but you know who buys the most rap music? White kids. White kids, that's who buys it, right? That's, without a doubt. So he hears this music, and he goes up to these teenagers and tells them to turn it down. Well, they get in this, screw you kind of thing like that. And what's pretty clear to me, since they didn't find a gun, and, his girlfriend, this Michael Dunn, who shot to death this teenager, sound familiar at all? Shot to death this teenager, this unarmed teenager, who he claims he saw a shotgun in their car, which was never found. And the defense said, oh, well, he could have gotten rid of it. They could have gotten rid of it. The kids could have thrown it out of the window or something like that. Well, one of the reasons the police never said anything about it, because that was never mentioned before. And in fact, he shoots to death this kid. Can you imagine that? Imagine yourself shooting to death some kid, right? Whether you thought he had a shotgun or not, or where you were just really angry because this black kid dared to tell you to get effed and to, get out of his face, or maybe just said, I didn't even say that. I mean, I'm looking at the worst case scenario on this. And so his fiance comes out and he says, let's get out of here. They get in their car. He doesn't say anything about shooting this kid to death. He says he has this altercation. He goes back. They order a pizza. Then he finds out the next day that a kid was killed. And he never mentioned anything to his fiance about that there was a gun involved. So the jury cannot figure out whether it was first-degree murder or not. And the prosecutors argue that Dunn did not shoot Davis in self-defense. He shot him, they said, because he was enraged that when he asked the teenagers to turn down the music booming from their vehicle in a gas station parking lot, Mr. Dunn described it to his fiancée as thug music. Mr. Davis did not do so. That's the man that was killed, the young teenager, and then cursed him repeatedly. Dunn, who was visiting from out of town, left the scene and did not call 911 or 911 or the police after the shooting. Instead, he returned to his hotel and the next morning drove 2.5 hours to his home in Brevard County. The prosecutor said his behavior did not jibe with the actions of a man who had fired in self-defense. Well, that doesn't that seem just obvious on the face of it? Let's see. Dunn testified on Tuesday that Davis had pointed a shotgun at him from the window of the Durango, threatened to kill him, and then tried to get out of the car. It was only then that Dunn said he reached into his glove box, unholstered his 9mm pistol, put a round in the chamber, and fired 10 times. Now, the coroner, what do they call those guys, the pathologist, testified that he was shot in a sitting position, right? He was shot in a sitting. So, I mean, this is all lies. He said it was Jordan who kept escalating this to the point where I had no choice but to defend myself. It was life or death. Well, where's the gun? Prosecutors argued that Dunn had fabricated his story about the shotgun to bolster his self-defense claim. Police never found a shotgun. I'm sorry, I lost the page here. And no witnesses ever reported seeing one. The fiancé also said that, they never heard that story before. The teenagers testified that none of them had a shotgun in the car. These were kids without, without criminal records or anything like that. Here's what's clear. And this is a pattern. If George Zimmerman wouldn't have had a gun, that Trayvon Martin would be alive and no one would have ever heard of this character, George Zimmerman, until he beat up his next girlfriend or did something, whatever he's been doing. If that ex-cop would not have brought a gun into that movie theater, that the young father that he killed would still be alive today, and the shooter wouldn't be in prison facing murder charges, and the worst that would have happened, he would have had popcorn thrown at him. That's when he shot. And so you just see this pattern of aggressive, angry men, and people often say, well, they're very fearful. Well, I don't think they're fearful at all. I don't think they're fearful at all. I think they're really angry, and they got these trigger tempers, and they can be set off. I mean, it's pretty clear that Trayvon Martin, you ever think about this? I mean, you know, people have made a lot about the fact that Trayvon Martin was walking home, or to his, what was it, either to his dad, I think it was his dad's house. He had Skittles in one hand, and he had some tea in the other hand. Then suddenly he's, according to George Zimmerman, the survivor, the only witness, I mean, he killed the other witness, is banging, Trayvon Martin is banging his head into the cement. Why in the world would Trayvon Martin do that? I'm dropping my Skittles, I'm dropping my iced tea, and I'm going to attack this guy that's walking towards me and bang his head into the ground. Well, I mean, the most logical thing is that George Zimmerman grabbed him. You know, he said, "What are you doing around here?" And maybe at that point, Trayvon Martin said what I would say. None of your effing business what I'm doing around here. Who the F are you? I might even say that. You know, I shouldn't. Should practice my Tai Chi and be mellow and all of that. But there's guys like that that really set me off, although we probably all should be careful because there's people like this Michael Dunn, like this George Zimmerman, like this ex-cop that are running around that have such a high level of anger that you never know when it's going to trip. And all these guys are law-abiding citizens, by the way. Law-abiding citizens. Yeah, they're going to take guns away from law-abiding citizens. Well, these law-abiding citizens shouldn't have had guns in those situations. They wouldn't have had the problems they did, and everybody that they shot to death would still be alive. No gun, all would be alive. Okay, let's see. We got time for some more, pardon me, some more calls. Here is Tina in Detroit. Tina, thanks for calling 248-544-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello. How are you?
I'm good.
Well, I was just driving home from my mom's with my dog, letting the dog go on a run, and it's only like 5 degrees out.
Oh.
And I'm just calling. I'm confused because I know we're talking about people carrying and shooting.
No. You want to talk about poverty. That's fine. We can always
That's
pick
right.
up. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. What's up?
Yeah, I could make comments on both. I mean, things are just getting crazy out there. I moved Seattle to Michigan and with my son, and I had a really good career, which got changed by all of the technology and the advent of the internet and the job boards and all this type of thing. And so what happened was, I ended up not being able to find a job. I spent, you have to go online, you have to go through this long application process of giving them your whole life story before you can even be considered for a job. And it's like, so you're spending all your time online applying for jobs. Once you do get interviews, you don't get you may not get the job until you're back to ground zero again.
Well, that's you know why that is, of course, that for every three people looking for a job, there's only one job available.
Right. And so you spend all this time, so you're spinning your wheels, and meanwhile you're scrimping and pennies, trying to pay your mortgage and pay your bills and have food on the table. It's sick when you look at people who do have jobs that have been, people that do have jobs, they might be making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000. You might have two people in one household making $200,000.
But Tina, that's very unusual. All of a sudden these figures are out of my head, but the number of people that make over $60,000 is, I think if you make $60,000 a year, you are in the top 20%. In other words, 80% of the population makes below $60,000.
Exactly. Okay, so now in comes companies like, all of these are Fortune 50 companies or higher, okay, uh-huh. Like Fortune 20 company. You've got you've got all the car companies and the oil and gas companies and insurance companies are at the top, and then you've got Walmart's number one.
Yeah, but before we list them all, because I'm kind of pressed up against the time. Give me your kind of your summary sense of what you're thinking.
Well, the whole system is crumbling. All these corporate America, they're after is their profits and their stock and their place on the Fortune 500 and their
sure.
and their dividends. Let's pay dividends. So that people will continue to buy our stock and will continue to be, rise higher.
Well, but they always were. I mean, when in the 1870s, the 1880s, when people were working 12 and even 14 hours a day and little kids worked in factories and people, and then when people started to organize unions, they got shot down in the streets. And the only thing that has produced a big middle class and a standard of living that is consistent with a wealthy country is two things, union and government standards. Left to the tender mercies of the owners, of the corporations, of the big companies, it would be like Mexico. I mean, absolutely. All right, Tina, thank you very much. Your point's well taken. Let's see. Here is Todd. Todd's in Madison Heights. Hi, Todd. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I got a couple of points on what you were just talking about, the young kid that was shot in his car.
Yeah, sure.
From what I understand, the police department didn't record the three witnesses in the car.
What do you mean they didn't record them?
Videotape them when they did their when they were interviewing them.
So.
So that left the defense completely open on what could be said. I mean, the police dropped the ball and left open anything that could be said about a gun, shotgun, and what he said. I mean, that's the police department should be looked into for not videotaping it.
Huh. Well, I thought it was, I just kind of passed over that one thing. I mean, teenagers sitting in a parking lot playing loud music. Wow, that's pretty weird. Have you ever heard of anything like that in your entire life?
I did it when I was growing up.
Me too. And, I mean, who in the world, what kind of aggressive guy comes up and tells, there was a young guy, sitting in front of our house, something with the neighbor, and I was out, it was last summer, I was doing something, and this guy is pumping some music out, and it wasn't rap. And I said, hey, I said, I wonder if you could do me a favor. I said, I wonder if you could just turn that down so you're the main listener to that. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I mean, I said it very nicely and all that. But to go up aggressive, I mean, if this guy would have been sitting in a parking lot, what the hell would I have the nerve? I mean, I don't mean I wouldn't have the courage to do it, but I mean, what right do I have to tell somebody in a parking lot to turn their music down? It's not my
parking
lot.
It's none of our business.
Yeah.
It's none of our business.
Yeah. So that's what I was getting at, that we have circumstances with three guys that are certifiably these angry guys that are packing weapons that are almost spoiling for a fight. And as soon as something happens, they're shooting away. All right. Thank you very much, Todd. I appreciate the call. We'll get some calls. Let's see. People want to talk about, I can't even say it, how do you say that? Obamanomics. Never heard that one before. Heard of Reaganomics, and some questions, some more about college, and we'll get your calls as well. This is our final segment coming up, so join us.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
Come to Verizon for free tablets and free phones on the best network. Today is your last day to get the Verizon Ellipsis 7 tablet free. Plus, get free activation and overnight shipping. Click the banner to shop now. Requires new two-year activation, upgrade, early termination, and other fees may apply.
If you're a certified auto tech, listen up.
Service manager or auto glass installer, listen up.
Holbrook Auto Repair is looking for certified auto technicians, service managers, and auto glass installers to staff their 13-day state-of-the-art facility.
Call 313-868-6000. If you're a certified auto tech, service manager, or auto glass installer out of work or looking for a change, Holbrook Auto is hiring now.
Call 313-868-6000. 313-868-6000.
Holbrook Auto Repair is hiring now. 313-868-6000. Call now.
License and registration.
But I'm walking.
Do you want to upset an officer of the law?
No, sir.
Good. I pulled you over today for littering.
I didn't litter.
Wow. That's what they all say. Unfortunately, I saw you drop a pair of thunder thighs a few blocks back. Probably happened as you were biting into that apple you're holding.
How'd you know they're my thunder thighs?
Well, my young friend, I'd like to say 2 years in the police academy helped figure it out, but between us, it was smallstep.gov.
Smallstep.gov?
Yep, Rooney. It's this site with tons of easy ways to lose weight. Some steps are so easy, people don't realize they're doing them. Like you taking small step number 83, snack on fruits. Go to smallstep.gov, you'll see. You can drive off now.
I'm still walking.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Julie is off tonight under the weather. Poor gal. And my computer crashed. Poor me. So nothing is updated, although still lots of good stuff at our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. My website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Coming up at 1 a.m., Elliot Adams. I'm doing this from memory because it's not up on the site. Although Jefferson is preparing our podcast, and that will be on our website, on our Facebook page today at noon. And anyway, Elliot Adams, past president of Veterans for Peace, a Vietnam vet, talking about he's about to go to jail for disorderly conduct at a drone base in upstate New York, near where he used to be the mayor. Also, Peter Linebaugh, an incredible historian who is, I wish I had the subtitle, The Stop Thief. And he's talking about essentially the theft of the commons, what we all share equally, the air, the land, what have you. Anyway, you'll if you're up, check it out. Okay, let's see. We're going to grab this call right here. It's Mike in Jackson. Mike, hey, you want to talk? Let me try it again. Obamanomics. There you go. I like it.
I'm asking you, elder tribesman, Peter Werby. I'm trying to help my younger woman friend with her economics course. I don't get to watch the news much because I'm traveling outrageously on my sales job. How about I tell you my understanding of Obamanomics and you tell me what I don't know?
Yeah.
President Obama came into office in, I don't remember, 2009. He delegated out the stimulus package to Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, which I perceived as an FDR-like Keynesian public works project. He did the Wall Street reform, which I think was long overdue. But all controversy aside, and I'm also very confused because I understand he was president 4 years, and the first 3 years he didn't get a budget passed. And President Obama did, under my last count, rack up $6 trillion on America's credit card, which is the deficit money already spent. The budget is a forecast of future spending. So I want to help my young woman friend. What is your perception of what is Obamanomics?
Well, I don't think there is an Obamanomics. And, I don't have any objection to using it. I mean, I think you hit it. It's traditional Keynesian economics. John Maynard Keynes was an English economic theorist who said that capitalism could not exist without huge amounts of government money injected into the economy that would have this stimulator effect. And the proof of that seems to be that it had its best proof during World War II. I mean, in other words, that there was still massive unemployment, even with everything that the Roosevelt reforms did during the 1930s. It was only the spending on World War II that finally got us out of depression, actually to an era of prosperity. After the war, there was great fear that the government was going to stop spending money, was going to stop taking essentially a wealth transfer, which is what all government spending is. It takes a portion of the money that we earn and other things that it taxes, and then distributes it in particular ways. I mean, some ways we all agree is good, some ways there's the dispute, some ways we all hate, and what have you. That there was a stimulus and that there were bailouts. Bailouts are sort of unusual, but I think these banksters caused it. That was a result of Reaganomics that said that there shouldn't be limitations on what they call the job creators, which of course turned out to be the job destroyers and the wealth destroyers for good sections of poorer people and what have you. But it's probably true that if there's not money injected into the economy, and we still have this World War II budget, except now it's called, rather than the war budget, it's called the defense budget, and there's, depending on how you count it, there's any way from $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of our money spent on war and preparations for war and even preparations for destroying the entire planet with atomic weapons. I don't know if that does it for you.
Hey, Peter.
What?
In closing, if people would smoke marijuana, there wouldn't be so many wars. Thank you.
Okay. Well, yeah, people who would be, like stoners, don't fight too much. Or do they? All right. Here's Jimmy in Harper Woods. Jimmy, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Big fan of yours. Respect your opinion. This is a little different question. Being that abortion is legal and women have the right to abort,
yeah,
which is fine with me, that's between them and their maker, you know, if they believe in God. Me personally, I'm pretty much an atheist. My question is, if they're allowed to do that, how come people that do hard drugs, and of course I know it's against the law, that they're not allowed to, you know, ingest into their bodies those particular things? It just seems hypocritical to me. If that argument were to be brought to the highest court in the land, where would it stand? Is it? Am I out of line? Or?
Well, you can always suggest anything. I mean, but no different than the anti-choice people are, who I call the compulsory pregnancy people, because essentially they are granting personhood. In fact, there's even, there's attempts, that's a whole movement, that they want to relegate or create a personhood to fetuses, which is has no previous bearing in law or maybe in morality or in religious theology, probably be a better way to say it. But and they can do it. I mean, they can try. I mean, they can say, you know, if you're carrying out an abortion, it's murder. If you're carrying out an abortion, you're killing a child. But there's nothing in other than their sense of their theological sense that that actually you know gives any credence to this. But you listen, you know, they're welcome to try. But I find it pretty objectionable. Because essentially what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the political state to enforce their theological and biological view of things and essentially take control of women's bodies and force them to have babies whether they want to or not. What is really contradictory is if you say to these people, well, why don't we allow free contraception for whoever wants it and, in fact, encourage young people but through education, to whenever they're having sex, to use it and to make it not an expensive item and to have a lot of education around it. There's some guys, you know, that don't want to use condoms, for instance. Like, well, they always say it's like taking a shower with a raincoat on, you know, all that. Well, it's better than babies and it's better than STDs. That's what I would say. All right. Thank you for thinking about those things, Jimmy. Let's go to Ken. Ken's going to tell us the UAW story. Ken, hi. It's Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. Hi. Yeah, I wanted to hear a little bit more about the UAW in Tennessee there. Why didn't it pass, or how didn't it pass? Does it stand a chance to appeal?
Well, there's no appeal, although Bob King, the president of the UAW, said they were thinking, I don't think they're going to get anywhere with it, they were thinking about an appeal saying that there had been undue interference in the process, because there was all these threats from the governor and from these senators and what have you. Essentially, if there would have been 50 votes changed, this was, by the way, people may be just joining us, there was a union recognition vote at the VW plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. VW, the company, the corporation, who all of its other 105 properties throughout the world, and particularly in Germany, are all unionized, and they all have work councils that are made up of management and workers where they address problems of the plant, scheduling, work rules, and what have you. VW really wanted it because that works well for them. But these right-wingers, just because they have this visceral hatred of unions, and there is this anti-union sentiment that's deep in the South I think it's really, like I said, and I just passed over, no one commented on it, I'd be curious to see the racial breakdown of the people that voted against it. My bet would be that it was 100% white, because one of the things that the anti-union forces did, and this wasn't the company. It's always the companies that are opposing the unions. In this case, it was these right-wing politicians and these right-wing groups from out of state that came and put up billboards saying, linking the UAW with Detroit, which is cool with me. That's where it started. That's where the headquarters is. But it would say, you know, Packard Motors brought to you, and then they show the old Packard building, brought to you by the UAW, which is just nonsense. I mean, Packard stopped producing cars like in 1958. And the other thing, and more directly, where you see the subtle, what they call a dog whistle of racism, they had billboards that said United Auto Workers, and they had auto crossed out, and it said Obama. So it said United Obama Workers. I mean, David called in from Detroit, and he said maybe a lot of them didn't want to be associated with a union that is so closely connected with the Democratic Party. Well, if they would have said, well, yeah, I want to, I want to be an independent. I don't want dues going for that. It's one thing. On the other hand, why do I think that a lot of these, working class saps down there are probably, Republicans, you know?
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I was just amazed that it didn't go through. And yeah. I was,
you know what, Ken? I hate to say it. I knew it wasn't going to go through. It broke my heart. I mean, for one thing, Like I said, I know Bob King. I know the head of public relations there. Jalene and I, for a while, 10 years ago or so, worked for the UAW in their broadcast department. And talk about people that put their heart into it. And you couldn't do anymore. I mean, I'll tell you, I think the union is screwed. I mean, if they can't win an election where the company is not opposing it, how in the world are they going to win? And I'm not criticizing the UAW for this. They did everything that was possible. But if we're in an era where people can't understand the importance of unifying as a as a workforce, I just don't even know what to say. I don't know what in the hell is ahead for us. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. We're still getting some calls in on the question of college. Let me see. Colin from Howell brought up the whole idea that I said that college should all be free, and he said that he thought it was an incentive, there was an incentive for people that really wanted to go, that had ambition. I don't know, this sounds terrible. I know we're supposed to have ambition. I never had very much ambition in my whole life. And a lot of my friends do, and a lot of my friends have accomplished incredible stuff. But I don't know. I guess I'm just a slacker. And, I'm not a total slacker. I do my part in the world in terms of employment and the way I function to try to make this a better society. I take part in my block club, stuff like that. And if you're not like a driven person, I mean, does that mean, boom, you're not a good human being? It sounds terrible. Anyway, Colin from Howell called in and said people are beginning to realize that money is pretty insignificant and are able to focus on being happy. Well, I don't know. I mean, I agree that we should think. I don't think the world is about accumulation of stuff. That's for sure. But here, let's get some more calls in before we go to our interviews. Here's Ron. Ron is in Shelby. Hey, Ron. Hi, it's Peter. Hi. You're on
the air.
Good
evening, Peter.
Good evening.
I just want to comment on your college thing. I think you have something there. I think it would work, free college. All this money that this country has spent on wars, I think if they spent it on college tuitions for students, I think this country would be in a lot better shape. And I have another.
Let me ask you one thing, though. Did you go to college by any chance?
No, I went to a trade school, machinist training trade school. But I've got some very interesting figures for you.
Sure.
I believe it was put out by the U.S. Department of Education. Okay, figures show that, I forget what the figure is, but the amount of money that this country has spent on wars in the last 10 years could have paid for the college tuitions of all the students that have gone to college in the last 10 years with $750 million left over.
Well, I guess in many ways that's our choice. But, I think people finally figured it out with this thing with Syria, because I think the Pentagon and Obama was all set to just trash Syria, which wouldn't have done a damn thing. But we had just come, we haven't come through Afghanistan. It's still going on. And we know that the Iraq war was just based on a pack of lies. And I guess we're just not into having another war in another foreign country. And that's it. The idea was we would just go in with, what do they call it always? Surgical strikes, right? We would go to in Syria and then be out of there. Well, I think if people wouldn't have stood up, people on the left, people on the right, independents, and said, no, we're not doing this, we'd probably have, we're only going to put 5,000 people over there, right?
Right.
So.
Oh, Peter, do you realize that every war that we've been in since World War II has been illegal? It's an illegal war. Are you familiar with Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11? Of the Constitution, it states specifically that the president, first of all, does not have the authority to declare a war. Only Congress has the authority to declare a war only if we are attacked first.
Right. Yeah. No, for sure. And we also haven't won. Have we won any? Let me see. They say we won Grenada and Panama. Both of those were pretty sketchy as well. Yeah, the idea that the presidency, under all presidents of both parties, has risen almost to this imperial presidency is not what the founding fathers had in mind. The duty of the executive was to carry out the decisions of the Congress, and one of the most serious ones, as you're indicating very correctly, Ron, was going to war.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, my friend, thank you very much for calling.
Okay, thank you, Peter. You have a good evening.
All right, you too. All right, we're going to wrap it up. I want to thank Jefferson so much for grabbing those phones and also becoming our in-house research department. Helped a lot with some of these statistics. Jefferson writes here, 16% of people in America are below the poverty line. And that's the official poverty line, which is way low. And I've seen better statistics that say that the almost about 45% of Americans are either poor or near poor. All right, check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. And if you want to write me after the show, I tend to, write back later in the week, sometimes weeks later. Some people say, I wrote you 4 months ago. I go, well, I'm not saying it. Yeah. You can write me, Angeline, at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Pardon me. And also, please check out my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. A couple of really interesting interviews next. Elliot Adams, past president of Veterans for Peace, a Vietnam vet. You can go to veteransforpeace.org. All you vets might be interested in this as well. Peter Linebaugh, the great historian from the area here, has written a book called Stop Thief. All right, Jalene was out. Let's wish her a speedy recovery from whatever bug she's got, and I'm sure she'll be back with us next week.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Whether it's a serious fall, fire danger, or other type of home emergency, Life Alert is there for you. The company, with its slogan, Help, I've Fallen and I Can't Get Up, protects its members. Here are some of them.
When you have a heart attack like I did, and there's no one there, Life Alert was there for me.
Having a secure feeling through Life Alert is ideal.
My independence is possible because of it.
Now, Life Alert can also protect you in a fire emergency with a system that automatically notifies our monitoring center.
Thanks to Life Alert, you can live alone without ever being alone.
With Life Alert protection, elderly people can avoid or delay going into a nursing facility. For a free brochure about Life Alert service, call now, 1-800-404-2454. That's 1-800-404-2454. Call Life Alert now for your free brochure at 1-800-404-2454.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I might look like an adult, like a person who could possibly be a parent, but I have no idea how to talk like one. And everyone knows that if you want to be a parent, you have to sound good when you say things like, "Don't make me turn this car around," or "Because I said so," or "Don't make me come back there." I don't even really know what those things mean, but I know that I actually believed my parents when they said them to me. How did they manage to sound so convincing? Here we go. "Don't make me come back there." Ugh, no, that's not tough enough at all. Kids can sense weakness. "Don't make me come back there." Ooh, yeah, that's better. In fact, that kind of sounded like my dad. Weird.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to listen to you practice your dad voice. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is your Car Care Minute. Drivers are keeping their vehicles longer these days and will eventually need the services of a reliable auto repair shop. With that in mind, here's some tips on how to choose one wisely. Start shopping for a repair facility before you need one. Ask your friends and associates for their recommendations. Don't choose a shop based solely on location. look for a neat, well-organized facility. The staff should be courteous, and the service technician or consultant should be willing to answer your questions. Look for evidence of certified technicians, such as the ASE sign. And when you do select your facility, reward good service with repeat business and customer loyalty. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
When I grow up, I want to be a new pair of blue jeans.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's first computer.
When I grow up, I want to be a glass countertop in a new home.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's best birthday present.
When I grow up, I want to be a football stadium.
When I grow up, I want to be a warm place on a cold day.
When I grow up, I want to be a fancy
backsplash. I want to be a bike that races around the
country. When I grow up, I want to be a bench on a forest trail.
When I grow up, I want to be a rocking chair on
when
a sunny porch.
I want to be a skyscraper.
I want to be
a... I want to be a...
I want to be a...
I want to be
a...
I want to be
a... I want to be a...
When I grow up, I don't want to be a piece of garbage. And if you recycle me, I won't be.
Give your garbage another life. Recycle. Learn how at iwanttoberecycled.org. A public service advertisement brought to you by Keep America Beautiful and the Ad Council.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The 2014 Riff Rock Girl Search is on.
Please get more details or apply online now at WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me, Peter Werby, here with you. I got a notice from the Syracuse Post-Standard. It said, DeWitt Town Justice David Gideon sentenced 12 people to jail and ordered them to stay away from the Hancock Air Force Base after he found them guilty of disorderly conduct during a protest back in October 2012. That's a while ago. He sentenced the people to 15 days in jail. Most of the defendants are in jail now, and it has to do with drones. And one of the people involved who is not in jail yet is Elliot Adams. Elliot Adams is the past president of Veterans for Peace, and we're reaching him. And, you know, hi, Elliot, you're on the air. I forgot to ask you, where are you? What city are you in?
Peter, I am in upstate New York, about 2 hours, actually, east of Syracuse, New York, where the Hancock drone base is.
Okay, and so I didn't know that. There's a base that is just specifically for drones?
Correct. It was an F-16 fighter wing, and they turned it into a RQ-9 Reaper drone attack wing.
Okay. Now, you were the past president of Veterans for Peace, and what's your military background?
When Vietnam War was raging, I volunteered for the Army. I volunteered to be a paratrooper. I volunteered for Vietnam. I wound up serving in the infantry as a paratrooper in Vietnam, Japan, Korea, and Alaska.
Wow. And so how does one make that transition from what you, I don't know if they still use the phrase, but from a gung-ho GI to the past president of Veterans for Peace?
I think that you see war. I think you'll find that the majority of combat vets, people who've actually seen war, come out and recognize that in various levels. So I came out personally not knowing whether war was unavoidable or whether it was sort of a necessary evil, but recognizing that there's no way this process could give birth to peace. But if you look through history from generals on down through privates, you'll find that probably the majority of people who have been actually in combat, not the stateside soldiers, they never learn, but the people who have been in combat come back appalled by the experience, struggling with the experience, and frequently coming to recognize that the only solution is to end the war, not to continue these wars.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I would not have thought just empirically, and you have a better perspective as a combat veteran, to be sure, But I usually think, when I think of veterans organizations, the main big ones, Veterans for Peace, of course, is very important. It's always played an important role in our politics here over the last 50 years or so. But I usually think of, like, the American Legion and Veterans of Foreign Wars. People like that are, gung-ho and support every war that comes down the pike.
Well, they tend to, and that's sad. You have to recognize that the vast majority of veterans are not combat veterans. They used to tell us when we were in the field that, variously depending on who we heard, there was 21 or 29 soldiers to keep us, and people in uniform to keep us, each one of us in the field, which gives you roughly a ratio of 21, 29 to 1. And then that's in one theater. You have all the other theaters which aren't in combat. So the vast majority of people in uniform never seen combat, although I have to say the reality is when you talk to people, they always say their definition of combat is always whatever they had, wherever they were, and less close to combat.
Hmm.
So that's a varying perspective. I got to tell you, I was in the infantry. I call that combat.
Well, yes. Elliot Adams is my guest, and he's the past president of Veterans for Peace. And he's about to go to jail. We're going to talk about why in just a second or so. There was even a song at the time, but it was said at the time of Vietnam that the average combat soldier was 19. Does that fit you? Is that your profile?
Sure. I was just a young kid.
Yeah.
Somewhere in a box of rocks. If I had known then that I was offering my life for a country which in a few years, like now, would be willing to put me in jail for exercising my constitutional rights, would misuse the domestic violence laws in order to deny me my constitutional right and fundamental rule for the survival of a democracy, namely that I have the right to petition my government for redress, I'll be very honest. I don't think I would have done it. I don't think I would have gone, because I went thinking that I was serving a nation of ideals of that believed in for freedom, believed in democracy, and whether it did then or not, I don't know. But clearly now, look at it this way, Peter. The things we see drones doing in Afghanistan and Pakistan are appalling. We are killing children. We are killing women. The ratios of so-called combatants to people that people recognize are not combatants varies, but the numbers are often around 80% non-combatants. That's not. I don't want to be part of that country.
Well, in fact, I want to hear this story, too. You and 11 other people were arrested in October 2012 at a demonstration at the Hancock Air Base, which is a drone base, and you were found guilty of disorderly conduct. You were sentenced to 15 days in jail. The other 11 are in jail. Why is Elliot Adams still out, and when are you heading for the slammer?
I was on a West Coast tour at the time that the sentencing was going to occur, and so I spoke to the judge at the end of our court when we rested the defense, and we were scheduling the time to hear the judgment and for the sentencing. So I arranged with him to appear at a different date for my sentencing. The judgments will be the same, but the sentence will be the sentence will be the same too. So I go in on the 25th to be sentenced and go to jail.
Are you fearful of it? Are you concerned about being in a jail with quote criminals?
Well, I'm not a very fearful man. I figure that probably I won't die, and if I do die, I die.
Okay. Listen, you were convicted of disorderly conduct, and the old thing: if you do the crime, you gotta. If you do the crime, you gotta do the time, or something like that. In any event, what did you do? Why you were at this drone base? There was a protest put together
We don't call it a protest. I was there petitioning my government, to stop committing war crimes. That's not a protest. That's a legitimate governmental process. protected by the Constitution. We were there calling on our delivering an indictment, which would indict, because if you have the way our legal system works, if you have reason to believe a crime is committed, you indict, and then you arrest, and then you try them and find them guilty based on beyond a reasonable doubt. Those are the criteria. Clearly, there is reason to believe a crime is being committed. I think unquestionable crimes, but. So we were there. So we took an indictment. An indictment, which incidentally, we talked to a past Attorney General of the United States to help write up. So we were taking the indictment, and we were petitioning our government for redress. And of course, I have a personal thing, which is that personally, I want to alert the people in uniform, males and females. That they need to look at this question of whether they are committing war crimes. In my day, I didn't look at that, and I know that people were telling me, and I just wonder whether if one more person had tried to tell me, or people would try to tell me in one more different way, I might have heard. In which case, I would not be left with recognizing that. That the behavior in Vietnam was just loaded with war crimes all over the place. And what we were doing was completely out beyond the pale of international law. And, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about international law if you've got time.
Well, yeah, we certainly do, but let's do this. I'm still a little foggy exactly what happened outside of Hancock Air Base in New York State with Elliot Adams, my guest on the Peter Werbe Show, and 11 others, that you were convicted of disorderly conduct, because if you're simply at a location petitioning for the redress of grievances, constitutionally protected exercise, how did you wind up getting arrested for and convicted for disorderly conduct?
Well, obviously it's not really clear to me, but we were there. They as soon as we showed up, they closed the gate, I guess, to keep us out. I don't know what, and stood there with their M16s, et cetera. So I guess we were convicted because we blocked traffic and made it impossible for them to get in even though they were the one who closed the gates. But such is the case. And I think the important thing to understand is that this is key to the survival of democracy and our republic. If we allow our government to, I mean, we see similar things. We see Snowden, who was released extremely important information for us as citizens to have and understand what our government's been doing behind their backs. You know, it was Jefferson who said a well-informed public is necessary for a democracy, or that's about what he said. It's really important for citizens to understand and participate in their government if we're going to have a democracy. In fact, you know, I just need to say here, look, besides the time I spent in service, I have over 15 years in elected public office, including being mayor for two terms.
Wait. What'd you say? Mayor?
Yeah.
Of what city?
Of the Sharon Springs. As I say, being mayor of Sharon Springs is being a fish in a damn small pond.
Hey, well, wait, but you got sentenced by the DeWitt Town Justice, David Gideon. Is this someone you knew?
No. These are different townships.
No,
different
I know. Townships. Okay, I was just curious. Go ahead.
So I just throw that in there because I want to be clear. I am both familiar with government, and I have a lot of respect and appreciation for the importance of having government, but only government which serves the people, serves the needs of the people, and that is what democracy is about, is government. You know, we talk about government of the people, by the people, for the people. The key to that, after all these years, the key to that, I recognize, is by the people.
Sure.
It's got to be people actively involved. And by that, I don't mean just voting. I mean actively participating in your government at every point. And government needs citizens to be looking over their shoulder all the time. Anyway.
All right. Well, let's do this. Let's look at drones. My guest is Elliot Adams, and he is the past president of Veterans for Peace. You can go to veteransforpeace.org, and there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. And we've just learned that Elliot Adams is also the former mayor of where? I lost it there for a second.
Something.
Sharon Springs, New York.
Never heard of it, did you?
No. He and 11 others were arrested in October of 2012 at the Hancock Air Base, which is a drone base. And you said, Elliot, that the majority of victims of, or that who winds up getting killed in these drone strikes are civilians that have nothing to do with terrorism, that they're just what they come to be called collateral damage. Here's two arguments one could make. Well, hey, this is a lot better. I'm going to make them both first. This is a lot better than sending our troops in there. And if a few people get killed, well, that's the nature of war. And the second thing relates to that, because it is the nature of war. It used to be 80% of the casualties were military and 20% were civilians. Now it's reversed. I'm sure you know from the Civil War, when there were battles, that people would actually line up like on the banks of the Potomac to watch these two, you know, like a spectator sport. So this is just comes with the territory. It safeguards people like you who are in the military and in combat. Because this is being done from so far away, and it's just the nature of modern war.
Okay, good questions. Really appreciate them. Let's talk about safeguards people first, and then we'll talk about civilians. Actually, it doesn't. I think it puts the drones put our military people and the U.S. At risk. We know. You know, let me put it this way. Never mind the morality and the legality. Both, I think they're very immoral weapon and a very illegal weapon where they're being used. They're also a damn stupid weapon. They're a stupid weapon because you can't do any of the things you need to do in war. You need to occupy territory. You need to take control of things. You can't do any of that with a drone. But more importantly, we know from our experience that whether you want to call it guerrilla warfare, fourth-generation warfare, asymmetric warfare, they're all pretty similar terms. We know that. They are won and lost by winning and losing hearts and minds. You cannot win a guerrilla or a fourth-generation warfare without winning the hearts and minds. And we know that drones lose hearts and minds. We know that every single strike we make, depending on the numbers you have, somewhere between 20% and 90% of the people killed are innocent and had nothing to do with anything. And every single one of them had a whole series of relatives, friends, neighbors who are incensed and infuriated by what we've done. Are you familiar with the double strike process, the double tap process?
No, tell me, please.
So one of the things we've been doing is we fire a missile, and then 15 minutes later fire one in exactly the same spot.
Oh.
That is designed to kill the first responders.
Right.
Now that's the kind of thing which I don't care who you are, you know is wrong. You know it's wrong.
Sure.
And our U.S. military has been doing that as a policy. And the reason they get away with it is because we, the citizens, aren't looking over their shoulder and saying, wait a minute. No. You just crossed the pale. You just gone too far. And that's where international law comes in. But let me stick with this. So you have that. You have the fact that drones, you know, I've been under drones and when I was in Gaza. Drones, they're called drones because you can hear them. Having them hang there for just as long period of time, and knowing full well that any instant somebody 10,000 miles away may make a mistake and vaporize you, or your kids, just their presence is infuriating and irritating. And in Pakistan particularly, the Pakistani government has said we have no right to be there. So every time you hear one, every time there's been a strike, you as a Pakistani feel that once more your sovereign territory has been violated. So they just create enemies, and you can't be safe by creating enemies. That's just the reality. It doesn't work that
way. Let me pose this to you a couple of times, and this is very common usage in language. You say we do drone strikes. It usually what I do, I say the government, or is it purposeful? Are you using this plural pronoun we, because there's ultimately all of us are responsible in terms of either ignoring it or even supporting it?
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Do you think this is a democracy?
That's a long discussion.
Let me ask you this. Do you want this to be a democracy?
Of course. We all do.
Okay. If you want it to be a democracy, then it's got to be we.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just that complicated. And I'd like to talk about that, too, is the whole question of democracy. And, let me say it right now. When I was a young man, I believed that democracy was guaranteed by a body of laws, and namely the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Not that the Bill of Rights isn't part of the Constitution, after all this time I spent first in the military and then in politics, I've come to realize that just is not true. That we have lots of laws that aren't enforced, and and the laws we enforce and the laws we don't enforce, we enforce or don't enforce because of public opinion. And from this, I recognize that, look at all the violations of our Constitution that we're looking at right now because of people like Snowden and Manley, where we discover that they have been violating our our constitutional protection for unreasonable search and seizure. That they've been violating our constitutional rights of habeas corpus, et cetera, et cetera. These things constantly go on, and the only way we protect can keep them, and the only way we keep a democracy, and the only way we protect our rights is by the American people screaming and demanding that this not happen.
Well, let me pose this to you, and I always try to anticipate what listeners may be thinking.
Which I appreciate.
Yeah. I'm the devil's advocate, like some people think I am in any event, but regardless.
Peter, I got to tell you, whenever I'm at a meeting and somebody says, just being a devil's advocate, I always say, the devil doesn't need an advocate.
Yeah, that's right.
But go ahead, please.
Here he does, yeah. Okay. You have been an elected politician. And so you got there by virtue of being elected. And so one could say, rather than you, Elliot Adams, and other members of the Upstate Coalition to ground the drones and end the wars, what you really should have been doing, rather than being in front of an airbase, you should have been working to have a congressional representative put forth your point of view, and that the kind of, whatever went on there leads to a disorderly society in the matter. So, and you were convicted of disorderly conduct, and you're going to be spending 15 days in jail for it.
Sure. We are. I personally have written, my representatives have been at Congress, we collectively have. I have been arrested at the White House to try to promote these ideas. So I think that we leave no stone unturned. And I would put it this way, if you felt that a child had been murdered and children were continuing to be murdered, for example, would you be satisfied to try one technique, or wouldn't you feel that you had to use all recourses that were open to you to try to do it? So we have worked at the federal level. to try to get the government to change its policies, but at the same time, we work at the local level to try to get the government to change its policies.
When you had your trial, and I'm looking at the clock, we only have about 3 minutes left, it was in front of DeWitt Town Justice David Gideon. Was there a jury, or was it just the justice?
It was a bench trial.
It was a bench trial. Were you hopeful, and I'm sure you put forth some of these arguments, were you hopeful and or surprised at the verdict?
I am always hopeful that we can get international law enforced by local courts. And I want to talk about international law because sometimes when I mention that, people start talking about black helicopters and the U.N. taking over U.S. forces.
Well, I'll tell you, Elliot, we have about a minute and a half left, so
okay.
you've got to – this violates – right? The use of drones violates international law in
Correct.
A very heavy manner. Exactly.
And international law is just these fundamental ideas that are so basic that regardless of race, religion, or nationality, we believe in them. It's a very fundamental, basic stuff. That's why we are, and indeed, Article 6, paragraph 2 of the U.S. Constitution makes treaties and therefore international law part of our own law, and the Supreme Court has often ruled that way. So answering your question, yes, I am desperately want to see our local court incorporate international law in their rulings.
All right, you're going to jail for 15 days. Any plans? You just bringing a lot of books with you, or what?
Well, you usually aren't allowed to take in any books or take in anything. There's usually sometimes you can have them sent to you, but it's a complicated process.
And the other 11 people that were convicted of disorderly conduct at the protest at Hancock Drone Air Base, they're already in there. Have you been in contact with them at all?
I have not, because it's a two-hour drive for me to get close to them, but people near there have been, and we often, you know, you get attorneys who will go in and talk to people if that's the way necessary, because you do want to check with people and see how they're doing. But they should be coming out pretty soon now, because they've been in jail quite a while now.
No regrets on your part?
Yeah, I have a lot of regrets that my government is violating. Our government is violating our Constitution, and also is violating these very basic principles of humanity that are embodied in international law.
All right, well, Elliot Adams, thank you so much. Elliot Adams, the past president of Veterans for Peace, veteransforpeace.org is their website. They always welcome new members, and if you're not a veteran, I always find it a great source of what's happening among Veterans for Peace, actually. There'll also be a link on my website. It's Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Elliot Adams, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
Pleasure to be on it, and I always look forward to getting back to Detroit, where I've had many great times.
Ah, I wish we had talked about that, but thank you so much.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
Come to Verizon for free tablets and free phones on the best network. Today is your last day to get the Verizon Ellipsis 7 tablet free. Plus, get free activation and overnight shipping. Click the banner to shop now. Requires new two-year activation, upgrade, early termination, and other fees may apply.
Hi, I'm John Amos with another story about the legacy of Montford Point Marines. In August 1965, a group of Marine veterans and their active duty comrades met in Philadelphia to renew the bonds of friendship and share the experiences of men who had trained at Montford Point Marine Camp. From that gathering of 400, plans for a national reunion were made, and the Montford Point Marine Association was born. Now, with 36 chapters across the nation, they are gatekeepers of the Montford Point legacy, a legacy of the few, the proud. The Marines.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
My fellow family members, I know a place where style isn't just a privilege, and everything's on sale at 30% off, with great looks for every man, woman, and child, and that place is Old Navy. So what I'm asking you to do is hop in the car.
Okay, Mom.
Hurry into Old Navy for 30% off the whole store, 35% off for Old Navy cardholders, plus limited-time deals for the family, like kids' $10 jeans and $5 tees, now through Monday only. In-stores only, select styles only, excludes gift card and clearance, valid 2/16 and 17.
During these tough economic times when many families are living paycheck to paycheck, it can be easy to lose sight of the importance of saving for the future. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling wants you to know there are some simple steps you can take to set aside dollars each month for retirement, college tuition, or unexpected expenses that could come your way. Most important is to review all your expenses and establish a monthly budget. Then examine every spending category and cut 10% from each. You can't reduce fixed expenses like rent or mortgage or a car payment, but you can easily cut back in many other areas like entertainment or using mass transit when possible instead of driving. And take a look at trying to bundle services such as your cell phone, land phone, cable TV, and internet service. For more tips and to speak with a certified credit counselor who can start you on the right track, call the NFCC at 800-388-2227 or visit debtadvice.org. This has been a public service message from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
everything that rocks.
How many special people change? How many lives are living strange? Where were you while we were getting high? Slowly walking down the hall, faster than a cannonball. Where were you while we were getting high? Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide in a champagne supernova in the sky. Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide in a champagne supernova. A champagne supernova in the sky. Wake up the dawn and ask why.
WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I've learned so much from Peter Linebaugh's history, the work that he's done to give us an idea of how what has come before us influences what happens today and how some of those concepts, even from a while ago, still make a lot of sense today. Peter Linebaugh has a new book. It's called Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. Peter Linebaugh teaches at the University of Toledo in Ohio, but he's had an incredible teaching career. He's taught at Harvard and at Attica Penitentiary. He's taught at New York University and the Federal Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. He used to edit Zero Work and was a member of the Midnight Notes Collective, and he co-authored Albion's Fatal Tree, is the author of The London Hanged, which was a book that remains in my mind till this day. The Many-Headed Hydra, also he was co-author of. And the most recent book that we interviewed Peter Linebaugh for is The Magna Carta Manifesto. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Peter Linebaugh. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Peter. Glad to be with you.
Well, let me tell you this, and we can start this way. A colleague of mine looked at your book here, just published by PM Press, And Stop Thief, that's a common phrase when there is a theft going on. But then she read the subtitle and she said, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. She said, what does that mean? I said, well, I have a guest that's going to explain it all. So link those together, the common phrase Stop Thief and the not so common use of the word The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance.
Oh boy, Peter, that's quite a task for me. The first one, Stop Thief, just is an exclamation to shout out loud when a theft has taken place. And I think all of us don't need to have that explained.
Right.
You know, if your pocket's been picked at the market or the mall. But we do need to have it explained when our water is privatized or the land is put behind fences or suddenly the air is no longer clean. We don't really know clearly. We can't see who the thieves are. And this brings me then sort of to the history that enclosure means putting things behind fences, putting them behind bars, and enclosing the earth in different ways. And the commons goes back to a time when so many resources, very much like the street today, were shared. Just like the street is shared by lots of cars without needing to have fences, so the land and many other resources, forests, rivers, and the product of our own human labor, you know, extracted from the earth as in mining, for instance, was common. And that is the commoners themselves, the workers who worked with those resources, decided amongst themselves by experience and by rules how to divvy them up, how to divide them up. So in a way, this is a book which asks us the question, do we really need to have such a division between the rich and the poor?
Well, Peter Linebaugh, you taught at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and you weren't,
I did.
And you weren't too far then from the Boston Commons. So whereas that phrase is not in use really in the Midwest or other points west, it is in the Northeast. And tell us about the commons in America and how, you know, how that fits into the subtitle of your book, Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance.
Well, fits in two ways, Peter. The first is the Boston Commons is named after these English people who several centuries ago came over and they brought their own habits with them, which included having a green in the center of the village to pasture their cows so they could get their milk, cheese, and on special occasions, roast beef. So that's one meaning of commons. And the second meaning comes up, and it's almost impossible for us in the Great Lakes region to see it clearly because it's not under that name. But that is, well, no, I take that back. Remember Tecumseh,
Tecumseh was killed in 1811 at the Battle of the Thames in Ontario, but he had fought for the commons, and that was the way his words were translated. And by that he meant the region of land, forest, and game through which the indigenous people, you know, the Indians of that time, the Potawatomi, the Miami, the Shawnee, and so on, that was the way they lived. They lived with those resources. And so I think by the commons, you know, in the Great Lakes region, we'd want to include the, you know, the salmon of the Lake Michigan, or the, I mentioned before, the water. You know, can you believe it? I heard Marion Kramer speak the other day about the privatization of water in Highland Park.
Sure.
Yeah, it's just, you know, when I grew up, water fountains was just part of school and the factory and out on the street. And now it's being privatized. So there's an ideal example of how the commons can be enclosed. In this case, the water is put in plastic bottles. And it's awaiting successful resistance. But so there is a concept then that of a commons on the whole continent. You know, the Iroquois Confederation, Tecumseh's Confederation, and then going further west, you know, across the plains and then to the mountains and the Pacific. There are many forms of human commons before the enclosure of privatization. You know, some of that historians know, and one can easily figure it out from the history of barbed wire,
mm-hmm.
for instance. And there's another example of enclosure.
Well, let me just interrupt you to say, and I'll reintroduce you as well. Peter Linebaugh is my guest. He's the author of Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance, published by PM Press, pmpress.org, and there'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And one of the things in introducing you, I said that your historical work suggests solutions. I don't think I used that word, but I would mean that, suggests solutions for today. And so what you're saying is beyond just interesting, which it is, but people would say, well, yeah, that's what happens. This is called capitalism, and the idea that everything is owned by individuals is what our system is all about. And I mean, we do have some commons, as you said, the sidewalk, the street, maybe schools and what have you. But other than that, one expects to have enclosures, legal enclosures, and actual physical enclosures, and to the point where someone would say, yeah, so what's wrong with that?
Yeah, no, some enclosures are really necessary. I mean, you don't want to have the cattle pasturing in your own corn. You don't want to have your pigs in your own garden plot. So you do need to have boundaries. And it's the same with human beings. We want to have boundaries with one another. And commoners in the past have been very quarrelsome. As you might imagine, you know, when you want to exercise your elbows and plow a straight furrow and not have that furrow interrupted by your neighbor. So, but this causes such interaction among commoners and requires that we find forms of resolving differences rather than creating differences. And this is a big difference, I think. But of course, no one is in arguing for the commons. No one is arguing for the removal of personal property. And I've just come back from Mesoamerica, from Chiapas, and there I saw many examples of commoning, of pasturage, of gardening, of coffee beans. But at the same time, people also had their private allotments, you know, their own hut, their own house, their own place for their chickens. So all of this is negotiated, and it's the cause of great interaction. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you wrote me, you said you'd been in the Escuelita Zapatista in Chiapas,
yeah.
Chiapas being the southernmost state in Mexico, where the Zapatista movement, this rebel movement, began to resistance. One of the offered great resistance beginning 20 years ago to globalization and what's called neoliberalism. And you wrote and said that your experience down there, I guess that would be the little Zapatista school, Escuelita. You said that the experience was transformative. How did it affect you?
Oh, well, here, Peter, I'm afraid you and your listeners will call me a romantic.
Okay.
But nevertheless, I just felt so much at peace. I'm living in a very small village, you know, one among hundreds and hundreds in the forests and mountains, without police, without sirens, without locked doors, with health care for everyone, with education for all people. Call it utopia if you like. I called it paradise because I look for paradise on earth rather than in the sky. And I just felt so relaxed and then so happy. It seemed like dreams were being fulfilled, that it's possible to create another world that's not based on mine and thine. It's not based on class separations, you know, of the extreme, very rich, the top 1%, so to speak, and then those whose poverty and wretchedness and insecurity and labor produces the wealth of the world. You know, it's the old theme, Peter, and it's I don't think it'll ever die, but it's a call for justice, really. It's a call not only for equal opportunity, but for security, equal security, safety, health, education, housing, clothing. And I found this. You know, it was simple. There are certainly problems, but the people are working on those problems by discussion and by inviting students from around the world, such as myself, to come and visit and stay with a family and form firsthand knowledge of resistance to enclosures and the practice of commoning.
Has the Mexican government pretty much just given up and ceded this area in southern Mexico to the Zapatista movement?
What a good question. The Mexican government, I think, is very tricky. It knew that if it just killed people with death squads and invasion by tanks and drones, it would incur the wrath of the globe. So instead, they're doing something else. It's kind of reminded me of West Berlin during the Cold War. They're trying to make a nearby city, San Cristobal de las Casas, into a sort of a huge, enticing shopping mall where, you know, gems and goodies and could be bought and sold. And it was like, it's like Vanity Fair, you know, in the old Pilgrim's Progress, full of enticements for the eye. And so it's trying to offer money, saying, look, we will supply money so you can build a house out of cinder blocks instead of a house out of wooden slabs. We will give you a floor instead of packed earth. It will be cement. So it's not so much violence as it is the enticement of money and the commodity, which I think is the strategy of the Mexican state towards the Zapatista at the moment.
I suspect probably one of the greater inducements are electronic devices. That seems to be the new gold. Let's see if we
Peter,
can,
we're both missing something.
Yeah.
We're both missing something. Mexico is in the middle of a civil war, right, of the drug trade. And I think this is, we should certainly mention the huge violence that goes with this, and the temptations it has for youngsters to find a like an entrepreneurial future for themselves inside the drug trade. Isn't it terrible?
Sure. Peter Linebaugh is my guest. The book is Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. Well, let's bring it home. You're pretty close to the Detroit area. You teach at the University of Toledo. And let's make two analyses here. One, the how all of this relates to the poor, particularly emphasized in the city of Detroit, but also the middle class, which what we think of, it's the working class and the smaller middle class above it. But for the poor, they're inside the city of Detroit, with its emphasis on urban gardens and people putting together new educational systems, and some of them actually saying, we are going to be living a post-capitalist existence because we've been pushed out of the system. So does all of this have an application right inside the city of Detroit, do you think?
Well, it sounds wonderful. I'd like to meet and discuss and work with the people you mention. Yes, I mean, we have to, among ourselves, find some solution to the prison, to these huge institutions of punishment, and in, which are basically a kind of enclosure of human beings, a kind of middle passage, you might even say. So if there are people in Detroit now who are searching by gardening, by home construction, by new kind of schools, to find ways of making equal security for our future, then I think these are the, quote, the pioneers of our time. They, I think, have a foot in the future as well as in the present.
Well, as I was saying, that they've been essentially forced either to the margins and then in some cases absolutely outside of what we, most people would consider the normal comings and goings of capitalist society. In other words, no wage work, no commodity consumption, and then everything has to be reinvented and the best way to do that when you have little is obviously to do it in common. But what about people like me and people like yourself and other people listening that may live in Sterling Heights or Ann Arbor or middle-aged white guy living in a single home, and how does any of this have application to me? I'm quote okay. I mean, I may be living, I'm probably speaking for a lot of you, living from paycheck to paycheck. I may lose my job and go bankrupt because of health problems or something like that. But usually most of us think that what we're talking about that works for the Zapatistas and their communities in southern Mexico, or could work in for the very, very poor in the city of Detroit, does it have an application to us in the middle class?
Yeah, I think I like the way you said us normal people, and then began speaking of living from paycheck to paycheck,
yeah,
or being unemployment. In other words, our concept of what is normal has got to change. I mean, not only must we reinvent food and neighborhood, we have to reinvent ourselves. And this always becomes possible, and it happens surprisingly quickly in conditions of disaster. You know, when I'm so influenced by Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell, because she goes right back to the San Francisco earthquake of 1905 or whenever it was, right up to Katrina, and shows how in times of disaster, normal people suddenly have to rely on resources that they didn't know they had. And as you said, these resources are collective. They're of working with one another, with working with our neighbors. Then we can, I even go back to 9/11, and think of the men and women on board Flight 93, who, after deliberation, found a solution, for the security and safety of people who otherwise would have been, and sacrificed themselves, when they rushed the cabin and the flight came down. They, in other words, we citizens, we norm, quote, normal people, generally, without even knowing it, find that we do have these resources. And we're especially lucky now to have people in Detroit, to have people in Chiapas who have taken a step or two along this road ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we can learn from them. But we have to, as I say, we will change too. You know, we must change too. And we have to make some decisions about what kind of human beings do we want to be. Do we want to be lonely, grumpy old guys, you know, down in the basement? Or do we want to help out with the homeless, with the gardening? You know, not as a man, and with thinking and with deliberation, with the future. That means with the children and the youngsters.
Yeah, and not charity. Charity is vertical with human solidarity, which, of course, is horizontal. You know, back many people have either been, probably seen this on you know, videos or something. When during the period of the Red Scare in the 1950s, these Southern senators and Southern congressmen that ran things like the House Un-American Activities Committee, with their Southern accent, they would say to people they thought were members of the Communist Party, they would say, "You sound like a communist to me." Rather, they would mispronounce the word communist. But you, Peter Linebaugh, very provocatively call yourself, as you did in our last interview when I interviewed you about your great book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, that you were a communist. And it's probably self-explanatory from what's come previously, but maybe just explain it a little more.
Well, it's anti-capitalist. It's anti-imperialist. In saying anti-capitalist, I don't mean I'm against resourcefulness and entrepreneurship and earnest endeavor. And in saying I'm an anti-imperialist, I'm not opposed to travel and getting to know people around the world. It just means I'm against being a bully. And I think there's more ways of organizing our human lives together than devil take the hindmost or dog eat dog or, you know, competitive individualism.
Well, let's do this, and I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I look by the clock that we're almost out of time. Your book, Stop Thief, has the subtitle of The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance, and there's little sparks of it. But in the depth of the Depression in the early 1930s and in through the 30s, there was great agitation and resistance among the poor people and the working people and unemployed. There were unemployed councils. There was huge movements for unionization. There was demands to open up the factories and start production again. And there's stuff going on for sure. And if you really look closely, you may be able to see it. But it's not of the scale. Are you hopeful that there will be a popular resistance, or are we just going to have to have the audacity of hope, which I think is pretty empty, you know, just hoping things happen, where we will remain, rather than being the subject of history, we're its object. So hopefulness, is it there in your mind?
Yeah, I think, as they say, we make the way by walking. We have to take the steps, and then we walk by asking questions. And I think the resistance is there. I think the quiet that we find in, say, the Great Lakes region at the moment is people trying to cope with health care, with lack of income, with the shaggy state. And also, I think there's a note in the quiet now of thought. There's a note of thinking, a deep kind of thinking. And I think, though, also, Peter, what I hear from you is that a book is not enough, and we need far more active agitation, far more speaking out. I don't mean necessarily yelling, and I don't mean yelling "Stop Thief" all the time. I think we can just point out the thievery. And I think we do, perhaps you know, the park bench, the place where you can sit and talk with neighbors, the where you can have an assembly. This, I think, is so important. And the this one criticism of, I have of the Internet is that it isolates and individualizes us, despite the many advantages that it has. So that's one thing I do hear from you. But also in the U.S. now, we live in a very repressive society. And outside of the U.S., especially in Spanish-speaking America, but also in other parts of the world, there is far more resistance and activity and knowledge even. So I come back to the U.S., going into a place where the light is not very bright.
Well, let me do this because we're right out of time. And a book, though, is a good place to start often. And Peter Linebaum's latest book, Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance, is an excellent place to start. You go to pmpress.org, and you'll find it there. Also on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Peter Linebaum, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
You're very welcome, Peter.
If you're looking for a beer to drink with your friends after Pilates class, well, this might not be the beer for you. Matter of fact, maybe you should stick to water. WRIF Lager from Atwater Brewing Company. Two Detroit legends, one great beer. Learn more at WRIF.com.
Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary, prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com or at the WRIF studios during regular business hours.
What you missed from Dave and Chuck the Freak on the Rift.
Has someone's name stopped you from dating them? Dave.
Yeah, it's not an odd name. Her name was Ashley, but it was odd spelling. She spelled it A-S-H-L-E-I-G-H.
And the spelling of her name stopped you from dating her.
I don't know what it is. Just I'm just lazy and I don't feel like writing that out a bunch.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
That's ridiculous.
No, I get it. Kelsey.
I could not date anybody with the name Scott. As long as I've known, everybody named Scott is either bald or balding, and I'm just so not into
What's
that.
What's wrong with that, sweetie?
Every single one I've ever seen in my entire life is bald.
Bald is awesome. So suck on that. Okay. Probably has a huge vagina. What was her name?
Do we remember?
No, I forget her name. That's unforgettable.
Detroit's new home for Dave and Chuck the Freak is 101 The Riff. The 2014 Riff Rock Girl Search is on. Ladies, you could be one of our four finalists heading off for a photo shoot in Riviera Maya, Mexico at the Grand Bahia Principe Coba, courtesy of Apple Vacations, and maybe earn a $40,000 salary as WRIF's entertainment reporter in the coolest gig you'll ever have. WRIF's 2014 Riff Rock Girl Search, brought to you by Jose Cuervo Singe. Get stung. Ladies, apply now online at WRIF.com.
Let me start by giving you some serious and important information.
Dave and Chuck the Freak's kick-ass game. No farming, no candy, no bull.
That's right.
Developed right here in the Motor City by Red Piston Inc. Check them out online at redpiston.com. Get it from the iPhone App Store or Google Play Store now. Or click the link at WRIF.com.
Full volume.
Full volume.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
High fidelity stereophonic sound.
Everything that rocks.
My money, bitch.